Call to order this hearing of the Committee on State and Local Government Operations and Oversight for Thursday, April 12th. Clerk will note that we do have a quorum. We have before us the minutes from Wednesday, April 11th. There's one correction to be made that I'm aware of, and that is under the testifiers for Senate File 1075 to insert the last name of Dolph, D-O-L-P-H, after Christina, who was a student witness from the University of Minnesota. We'll ask members to look over the minutes for a minute and see if there's anything else that you notice that needs to be corrected.
Move the minutes.
Senator Pappas moves that the minutes be approved as corrected. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We're going to start a little bit out of order today. Senator Scogin, we'll get to your bills as soon as we finish with Senator Higgins. Senator Higgins brings us, which one is it? Number 7 on our agenda, Senate File 827. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To start with, I have the A5 amendment.
Beg pardon?
The A5 amendment, if Mr. Bodden will have it passed out to the members, that'd be great.
Maybe she just wants to go.
Madam Chair, this is a bill recovering or requiring coverage
for
interpreter
services. Excuse me, Senator Higgins, I need to get the bill in front of me.
By the
just
health plans and
just one
this
second.
Amendment.
I need to get the bill.
Oh, okay.
Okay, Senator Higgins, thank you.
Okay. One of the louder people around here, so.
I'm sorry.
I bumped Senator Anderson yesterday at the Jobs Committee.
Senator Higgins.
You ready? Okay.
Yep.
Madam Chair, this bill requires that the health plans will cover interpreter services for both deaf and hard of hearing enrollees and people who need language interpreter services. It is effective July 1st, 2008. And in the meantime, we put together a work group. And the charge for the work group is at the bottom of page 2 and the top of, well, it was on the bottom of page 2.
Senator Higgins, have you looked through the guidelines for work groups and advisory committees, et cetera, for this committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, and the A5 amendment was put together to
address
add the things in this bill that we didn't have.
Okay, if you would just go through as what if we incorporated the A5 amendment, how then Section 2 answers the issues in the guidelines, and we'll be able to go through this very quickly.
Madam Chair, the task force would be called the Interpreter Services Work Group. There is no other group in existence by that name. There are would be 18 members in this work group. The Commissioner of Health would appoint the members in consultation with the Commissioners of Commerce, Human Services, and Employee Relations. There is no Senate confirmation needed for any of the appointments. The duration of the appointment is the duration of the study, which would conclude with a report to the legislature January 15, 2008. The convening authority is the Commissioner of Health. We don't have anything in here that says who the chair will be, at least I assume for the first committee.
Commissioner of Health will
it will be the Commissioner of Health.
Mm-hmm.
We're not providing compensation or expenses for members. It has no subpoena power. The duties for the work group are the following. It would develop findings and recommendations on assuring access to interpreter services, complying with requirements of federal law and guidance, developing a quality assurance program to ensure the quality of healthcare interpreting services, including requirements for training and establishing a certification process, and identifying broad-based funding mechanisms for interpreter services. There is no sunset included in the bill, but the work group's work would suspend when the report is done to the legislature. There is no appropriation, there are no funds, and the state agencies, other than the ones that we've already talked about, would have no specific duties. The Departments of Health, Human Services, and Employee Relations will each provide one staff person. There are no duties by the Commissioner of Administration. We do not put in this bill the number of meetings that they would have, and we don't put any specific requirement on quorum.
Senator Higgins, with your amendment, you satisfy all the guidelines. Senator Larson moves adoption of the A5 amendment to Senate File 827. Any discussion of the motion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 827 before us. The jurisdiction of this committee is on the working group. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 827 as amended? Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that Senate File 827 as amended be recommended to pass.
Madam Chair, there's a fiscal note. It's being revised, but there's still a fiscal note.
Yeah, I thought there might be. And refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that?
As amended.
I said as amended to start with, yes, but thank you for reminding me. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you all for accommodating my schedule tonight.
Absolutely.
She's going out to dinner with her husband. Mm-hmm. My husband's working, so I don't have to worry about that.
Okay,
the Scogan
Senator
agenda.
Scogan, welcome
three
to
bills.
The committee. You have three bills. I'm assuming that you want to take up Senate File 1360 first.
That's fine.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
They've had something else on, which is really stupid, like the Black Donnellys.
Madam Chair, committee, you're looking at Senate File 1360. This is a Senate bill that is going to add participants on the Citizens Oversight Committee. If you look on page 2, you will see what we are doing to the committee. We are adding one member of the Senate, which will be appointed. This is on line 13. One member of the Senate appointed by the Senate Subcommittee on Committees of the Committee of Rules and Administration. And on line 15, one member of the House appointed by the Speaker of the House of Representatives. You might notice also that there is language on line 20 and 21 that the legislative appointees to the committee shall serve as non-voting members and are not eligible for per diem for meetings of that committee. Citizens Oversight Committee, if you look from line 14 on page 1 all the way through line 11 shows you the other people that are involved in those committees, and Bob Meyer is here from the DNR to talk further about this bill.
Senator Scogan,
yes.
Why would you deny members who are doing their work as legislators the opportunity to ask for per diem?
Or vote.
That's a fair question, Madam Chair, and the reason is the others who serve on that committee are given some mileage and a sandwich, basically, and they're asked.
And you would deny that to the legislators?
We're going to give them a sandwich.
They don't have to apply for it. They can volunteer not to take per diem.
Who pays the per diem?
That's true. They could volunteer not to take it. I guess we just didn't want to leave that in their hands.
Madam Chair?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, then the question is, who would have to pay the per diem? Is this the DNR? Is this the DNR
Senator
agency?
Senator Pappas, the legislature pays per diem for legislators, not a state agency. Senator Pappas, I wonder if you'd consider an amendment to remove that language?
I would. I thought that was kind of offensive, too, that if the legislature is willing to pay for the per diem to have people be on this committee.
Senator Pappas moves that the sentence beginning on line 220 after the period, line 221 and line 222, be deleted. Any discussion? All
Madam
in favor
Chair,
of that motion?
Madam Chair, before we vote, mm-hmm. we discussed the per diem issue, but I also didn't understand why legislative appointees would be non-voting members.
Madam
well, we
Chair?
can come. Oh,
no,
I see.
I don't
understand.
That's also on that line.
We might not want to take that whole
Well,
thing.
I just want to know why. I would prefer they were voting, but maybe there's a reason.
Senator Scogin, why are they non-voting?
I'll refer to us. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, members, the language that Senator Scogin amended to this language came from the Budget Oversight Committee, which is a group of citizens who do not receive any reimbursement other than mileage and dinner. They meet during the legislative session, so the legislative members will be receiving per diem already.
Anyway.
That's the reason for this. They are taking time off of their jobs and their work to come to the meeting. They felt that the legislators, if there was another meeting, should be having to take time off to be there as well. The non-voting part of it is because they make recommendations. Often they vote on recommendations to be made to the legislature, and they felt that there would be a possible conflict having legislative members take recommendations, perhaps on spending activities, perhaps on policy issues, that would then come to the legislature. One such example is they took a vote on a provision in the policy bill dealing with the program that they do not wish to fund. They thought it may perhaps present a conflict of interest to have legislative members voting on recommendations to the legislature.
Madam Chair?
Senator Pappas.
Well, where does that put the LCCR? I mean, the LCCR includes legislators who vote on projects to be presented to the legislature upon which they vote.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, the voting that they make recommendations on is policy-related at times. LCCMR recommendations are funding recommendations that come to the legislature.
So?
It's a difference.
Madam Chair, I don't see
Senator
the distinction.
Pappas.
Senator.
Mr. Myers.
Madam Chair, a couple of the recommendations they have made. One concerns Let's Go Fishing and the funding and the source of that. Another recommendation they made last year dealt with prohibitions on farm survey. They felt that if the board, if the council is going to be debating issues and presenting recommendations to the legislature, that perhaps they shouldn't have legislators trying to influence what this citizen board is doing right now. The legislator members are always open and invited to attend the meetings. For the past 4 years, I think we've had two members who have actually taken us up because they meet during session when other committee members are going on. So it's that conflict of scheduling time and things like that that they were concerned about. Your wishes as to voting or non-voting is certainly up to you. They were trying to avoid potential conflicts of interest or other issues that may come up.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I guess I wanted to ask Senator Scogin, why do you want legislators to be on this Citizen Oversight Committee, number one? And then I have more questions.
Well, I think the intent was to serve as more of a bridge between that committee and the two chambers. It's similar to when I served for an electric co-op. We had a committee of members of the co-op, and we also had a couple of our board members on that committee that did not vote, just to be there to help them work through some of the issues that would come up and how it might play out when it came to the full board.
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, Senator Scogin, I think that's a really good idea. You know this bill has to go to the Rules Committee if you have legislators on it. But that's the whole point of the bill, so I guess that's what you must want to do. Madam Chair, we legislators serve on a lot of different entities. I mean, we're voting members on the minority councils. We're voting members on the CAP board. And even though those groups often present policies or have funding requests before the legislature. So I just don't, not only does it not fall within the letter of law of conflict of interest, but I don't think it is a conflict of interest at all, even vaguely near one. So I guess I would go back to Plus, you cannot double dip with per diem. If legislators are already getting per diem because it's during session, they can't get an additional per diem for attending this meeting. That's built into the system. Right. If we remove this sentence, it would just be if they happen to meet outside of session, and then they still would have to ask their committee chair for per diem. So I would move that the new language on line 20, 21, and 22 be stricken.
You've heard the motion. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Scogin, one of the other things that I'm going to recommend and Mr. Bodern is preparing an amendment to do that. What we have found, particularly I think this year as we've had new majorities in the House and a new leadership in the Senate, is kind of a delay in some of the appointments to new groups that are formed or even old groups that are in existence. And we have put an amendment on this kind of legislation to require that the appointments be made in a timely fashion so that the legislators in this instance would be appointed and being able, and they wouldn't be appointed in December, they'd be appointed by Mr. Bodern.
Madam Chair, and I guess I'm not sure exactly which date you have in mind, but the new language would go on page 2 after line 35. You just create a new section 2. The new appointments required under section 1 must be completed by September 1st, 2007.
I was thinking that was too late. I think, Senator Scogin, you'd like these people to be involved as soon as possible.
As soon as possible.
So how about within
a month of enactment?
Or, yeah, within
this goes into effect.
The date of enactment, since there is no date, would be
August 1st.
August 1st, is that correct?
So Madam Chair, they probably won't meet again until January, so we do have
some time. You do have some time, so if we put September 15th, that should give enough time. Okay, so the amendment that Mr. Bodern is offering and that Senator Pappas will move is that the appointments made under the new appointments made under Section 1 be made by the respective appointing authorities by September 15th of 2007. You've heard the amendment. Is there...
Madam Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Is it appropriate to put the year?
I'm going to put September 15th, 2007.
Is it appropriate to put the year? Because wouldn't these be appointments that would be remade every 2 years or every 4 years?
This would just be the new... see what you mean.
Yeah.
Good point. I think we don't need the year because these... Well, let's see. Mr. Bodern, is that section going to be codified? How is that going to work?
Madam Chair, the proposed language would be uncodified. That does open up a larger issue. If you want to provide a date that would apply to subsequent appointments, I think it's unclear exactly what term the legislative members would be serving.
It's true, too. Senator Scogin, how long did you want these people to serve?
We were just discussing that, and we can put a number in there, 2 to 3 years, whatever your – 2 years maybe would be more comfortable, especially for the House members.
How long is the term of the other members?
Madam Chair, members, we reappoint the committee every year. Oftentimes it's the same members to the committee, mm-hmm. but we do appointments on a yearly basis. Mm-hmm. After they do their reporting to the legislature, you'll see in sections D, that kind of concludes that cycle, mm-hmm. and then we will establish a new committee.
Cycle. Mr. Bodern, how do we solve this issue here? If we would want the legislators to serve for the biennium.
Let's see. Madam Chair, what you could do then, you can disregard the proposed new Section 2.
Page 2, line 14,
September, well, set up maybe September 1st. You'd want to say.
Okay. After representatives. And what about the length of the term then? Where would we make a statement about that?
That would take care of it with odd numbered year.
Madam Chair, I think because you'd be requiring a new appointment each, even
that
or
would,
odd numbered
that
year, that would take care
assumed.
Of it.
Okay. Is that okay, Senator Scoten?
Yeah, thank you
okay.
for your help.
Senator Pappas makes the motion to further amend Senate File 1360 with the language that would indicate that the appointments for the legislative members be made by no later than September 1st of each odd number year, both for the member of the Senate and the member of the House of Representatives. Any further discussion? All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. I don't believe that any of the other guidelines are necessarily need to be addressed here. This bill will go to the Rules Committee. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak to either in opposition or in support of Senate File 1360 as amended? Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that Senate File 1360 as amended.
9.5 hours. That's 4.5 hours.
Okay. As amended, be recommended to pass. And refer to the Committee on Rules. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Scogan. Your next bill is Senate File 1185. Senator Scogan.
Thank you once again. Senate File 1185 is a agency bill from the DNR talking about acquisition of land for trails and some other general requirements, sticker requirements and fees. And rather than have me try to walk through that, I'll turn it once again over to Bob Meyer.
Yeah, and Mr. Meyer, of course, we're only the only jurisdiction we have in this committee is that Section 6. We don't need to discuss the policy, just the reasoning for the written orders in the to be published in the state register that is not subject to Chapter 14. And I believe that I saw earlier today a number of examples of where the DNR had been given that authority. Maybe it was for this bill, maybe it was for one of your other bills, but there is not an uncommon. It's not a rare occurrence, even though it's not a routine occurrence. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members, correct. The language you see before you that starts 3.23 to 3.26 is language that you see in many DNR sections. Several years ago, under the direction of Commissioner Merriam, we undertook a huge process of going through all the DNR statutes where we have the authorities given to us to make determinations. A lot of times we were just given the authority and it wasn't told how those determinations were made.
Mm-hmm.
We want to make sure that every determination that the commissioner has, the powers he's given,
is published.
It's absolutely clear. Either we go through expedited, full-blown rulemaking, or we do know that let the public know how it's done, published in the state register by written order. This is a mundane decision on how we designate a snowmobile trail in part of a closed forest, and we would just be doing it through written order published in the state register.
Okay, and in particular, Mr. Bodern, Section 14386 is, or Mr. Meyer, if you know that offhand, when you say it does not apply, which section particularly is that?
Madam Chair, I don't have that right in front of me.
Madam Chair, that section is designed to catch bills that want to exempt themselves from rulemaking simply by notwithstanding Chapter 14. If you're not careful enough to reference that section, then you're trapped. So it's belt and suspenders.
So it's the safe harbor from rulemaking. Okay, I'll have to remember that. Remember that, members, in case you want to get exempt from rulemaking in the future. Are there questions about this request for the written order by the commissioner? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak in either in favor or in opposition to this provision of Senate File 1185? Seeing none, no. Senator Rowland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, how often are the trails closed and for what purposes would they be closed?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, what we're talking about is a closed forest, and this is really a correction to pieces of our forest designation process as we're going through the forest in the state, determining them managed, limited, or closed for the ATV process. It does relate to snowmobiles as well. So a closed forest is one that trails are, it's kind of confusing. They're closed unless posted open. So a snowmobile, if you're familiar with snowmobiling or snowmobile trails, sometimes you're going off trail. You need to go off trail to get your the skids. There's plastic runners on your track. You need to get them wet, keep them cold, keep them lubricated. People often go off trail on snowmobiles. Because of the snow, there is no damage. You do very little damage. So this is making sure that people have the ability to go off trail on a closed forest. So to go off the trail, to make sure your machine is running properly where we have designated trail system.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So you wouldn't allow that where you just have a whole lot of little seedlings that they might run over, but in areas where it wouldn't harm any of the reforestation efforts?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Meyer.
Senator Roebling, I see our forestry tour with the bonding committee paid off. It does. It wouldn't impact that at all. These are, it's a common practice. We want to make sure that it's allowed, that somebody wouldn't be able to get a citation or be breaking the law for doing something. They're in areas that are large fields, typically, that they'll go off into.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Senator Larson, is there anyone who wants to speak either in favor or in opposition to the bill? Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that Senate File 1185, as amended by the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. There are fees in the bill. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Scogin. We now have your Senate File 961, Shoreland Resorts Regulation.
Madam Chair, I understand that Senator Scogin has an amendment. I would move that amendment at the appropriate time.
Okay, I need to get that amendment. Need to have it passed out.
That's correct. When we were in, Madam Chair and committee, when we were in Environment and Natural Resources, there was a little problem with some language. We promised to clean that up when we got here, and that's the amendment that you're looking at.
Thank you, Senator Scogin. Senator Larson moves the 0753 amendment. Senator Larson or Senator Scogin, you want to explain the amendment? Senator Scogin, just explain the amendment. This is not an author's amendment, so we need to have it explained before we vote on it.
Madam Chair, I'd like to defer to Joel Carlson.
Sure.
He helped build this amendment to the right words that they were looking for. So,
Mr. Carlson, if you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson, and I'm here on behalf of the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, which is an organization of small family-owned resort operations in Minnesota. The S-53 amendment is language that we worked out with the municipalities and local units of governments, and it conforms with existing law, Chapter 462, 375, Subdivision 1E, regarding nonconformities. And this is the identical language that is in existing law as it relates to municipalities as they impose restrictions on the ongoing nonconformities, and this just makes it consistent with existing law. The language that was added in environment created a confusion, a preemption of a preemption, if you look at the language. Mm-hmm. This just makes it clear, and I think everyone's in agreement with this language.
Madam Chair, the
Senator Scogin.
Amendment itself is a lot shorter than the explanation.
Yes. is everyone clear about the language of the amendment and what it reinserts in the bill? Is there any further discussion? Senator Larson then renews his motion that we adopt the 753 amendment. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 961 before us as amended. Senator Scogin, would you please explain your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 961, I grew up in the Lakes Country in Otter Tail County up near Phelps Mill. And on a small dairy farm, I was within 13 lakes, so within 5 miles of my home. And on those lakes, when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, were numerous mom-and-pop resorts. Three, four, five, six cabins. My sisters would clean on Saturdays. These resorts have come under a lot of pressure for various reasons. But this bill is an attempt to help those resorts to maintain, repair, and rebuild their operations when things occur that for the most part, not by their own doing, by the owner's own doing. Again, I'll ask Joel Carlson to explain that better, but it goes a long way toward helping some of these mom-and-pop resort owners stay in business, keep their facilities in good repair, and continue to offer economic growth in rural Minnesota, in the Lakes Country, not only for residents who can get away for a weekend, but also for those tourists who come from Indiana, Nebraska, Illinois, and the Dakotas to stay for a week or two. Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman and members, briefly, I think Senator Scogin's explanation just hit it on the head. We appreciate the efforts of the legislature to help small resorts in the past, and this is just an additional issue that we have had on occasions where resorts have been lost through fire and been unable to rebuild or been unable to make necessary repairs. This just makes a uniform statewide standard for their ability to maintain and repair their businesses. It keeps them in business, which is what we're trying to do. It is a unique part of Minnesota's heritage and quality of life. We're down to about 900 resorts left in Minnesota. We, at one point at its peak, had about 3,500. And this just allows them the ability to rebuild and maintain their facilities so that they are viable businesses. And we'd appreciate your support and happy to answer any questions. If you want me to go point by point through the bill, I'm happy to do that.
I'm just interested, Mr. Carlson, in hearing from the local governments because you are putting a duty on them that is not currently in law. Is there anybody here either from any local government organization that could speak to the bill, or Mr. Carlson, can you represent their interest as well as your own?
Yeah, I'm not here, although I have some local government clients. I'm not here representing them, but I can tell you that we have worked diligently with the League of Cities, the Association of Counties, and the Association of Townships. I do not believe they oppose the bill, but I'm happy to have them come up here and say that to you themselves.
Okay, is there anyone here from any of those organizations that could just give us a comment? Good evening. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members. My name is Annalie Garlitz. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and we have worked with the author and Mr. Carlson on this language, and we believe that the amendment makes us much more comfortable with the bill. It helps clarify that if we do have an ordinance that we do wish to protect stormwater, septic, or different sewage or well issues, that this helps clarify that we can do so with buffer strips or different provisions that we want to see. And that helps clarify that this is just relating to the definition of the resort, the maintenance and replacement, which is a piece that's already that was passed last year, that this just kind of clarifies that it also applies to resorts and then the expansion piece. So again, the amendment helps us feel far more comfortable with the bill.
Thank you very much for that clarification. Mr. McGowan?
Madam Chair, members, the amendment, as I read it, does not include counties. Is it the intent to include counties? Because it just says municipality, which under 103F does not include counties. We can easily add them if that's the intent.
Madam Chair and members,
Mr. Carlson,
in talking with the municipalities using the general term, we want it to include townships, counties, and cities. And if you believe that the language that we have does not in some way, that's something that we need to rectify. Senator, we think it includes them.
Senator Scogin and Mr. Carlson, if you look on line 2.5, in terms of the duties of counties, inclusive the duties of local governments, you do there separate county or municipality, and you do the same thing in 2.11. So I think Mr. McGowan's point is well made, that we may want to amend the 753 amendment by inserting after A.
What about townships?
County or.
Or A.
Or A.
So it would read, Madam
A
Chair,
A county or a municipality.
On line 2?
On line 2 of the amendment. Senator Larson moves to amend the 753 amendment previously adopted by inserting on line 2 of that amendment, after the word A, insert county or A. All in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, if I might ask to have some grammatical changes made on 215 and 217, the structure being any larger and thereof being any closer drives me crazy. Could we not say on line 15, must not result in a structure that is any larger, or on, and on line 216, any portion that is any closer? Does that work, Mr. McGowan?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, that's an excellent suggestion.
Mr. McGowan, would you read that back to us?
My students would get an F for using that word.
Okay, Madam Chair, it would be on page 2, line 15, delete being and insert that is. And on page 2, line 16, delete portion, or no, thereof, and insert that is.
And delete being.
And delete being.
Yeah. And delete. Madam Chair?
Senator Pappas.
Mr. McGowan, does it make more sense on line 215 to say a structure instead of the structure? In the structure that is any larger sounds kind of funny. A structure.
It is referring back to the replacement structure, right. So I believe that the structure is
the structure.
Is
okay.
Correct,
right.
Here.
All right.
You've heard Senator Pappas's correction on lines 215 and amendment for 215 and 216, 217. Any discussion of that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is there any further discussion of Senate file 961 as amended?
Madam Chair, I would just add that
Mr. Carlson.
I'm house trained, as many of you know, and that was language that was added by Representative Osment, and I didn't like it either, but I didn't want to change it because it was his. So I appreciate cleaning it up.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, Senator Osment and I are in the same class, as is Madam Chair, so you can blame us.
Okay.
Move the bill, Madam Chair.
We have Senate File 961. Senator Larson moves that Senate File 961, McPherson Grossman, as amended by this committee, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator.
Madam Chair and committee, thank you very much.
Let's see. Senator Sieben, are you present? Yes, you are. Senator Sieben brings us brings Mr. Meyer back with Senate File 728. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate File 728 is, I believe, relatively simple. Right now, when the Department of Natural Resources holds contested case hearings on permits or orders, if someone does not agree with that, with the DNR decision, they have the right to seek administrative review under Chapter 14, the Administrative Procedures Act. but there's a state statute that requires the DNR to publish the notice of the hearing at the expense of the applicant. And that statute requires that the entire notice must be published. And essentially what this bill does is allow for a summary of that notice to be published in the paper. And
Mr. Meyer morphed into Mr. Lockeswell.
Yep.
Mr. Meyer's name was on the witness list. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record, if you'd like to speak to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Kent Lockeswell, I'm the director of the Division of Waters for DNR. What Senator Sieben said was accurate. What I'd like to say first is what this bill doesn't do. This doesn't restrict anybody's rights to demand a hearing. It doesn't exempt the hearing process from Chapter 14 process or Chapter 14 notice. But DNR is one of the few agencies, if not maybe the only agency, that actually requires that notice to be published in the paper. And over the last couple of years, that notice, from advice from the Attorney General's office, has grown to be a very lengthy notice and quite expensive. We've had bills of up to $900 for the publication of these notices. Those costs are paid by the applicant. And I could, I have a couple of these I could hand out, but I have a notice for the, if you just see in the yellow, is what we would have for a summary, and what's been published has been the rest of this notice. And this would provide for anybody that actually reads legal notices in the paper to understand what's being proposed for hearing, and they'll have a source to get the full notice if they wish. We could provide them electronically. This will save applicants money. We think it's just good business to do this way. There's no fiscal impact on the DNR. There's actually a cost savings on an applicant.
And do you have a fiscal note that shows the cost savings, Mr. Lockesmoe?
Madam Chair, no, we don't. There is no cost savings or cost to the agency because all of these costs are required to be paid by the applicant or the violator.
I
so the agency
I understand.
Sees no gain or
it's,
loss.
It's going to be a gain for the applicant by not
Chair,
having to pay for this extensive notice.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Are there questions or comments for either Senator Sieben or Mr. Lockesmoe? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either in support of or in opposition to Senate File 728, the first engrossment?
Madam Chair, one other point that I could make is that we have asked the administrative law judge to look this over, and they had some changes, and those have been incorporated. So they're
inside the first engrossment already.
Yes, they are, and
okay.
they agree with this concept.
Senator Bickerman moves that Senate File 28, as represented by the first engrossment, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Sieben and Mr. Lockesmoe. We now have Senate File 2059, Senator Erickson Ropes. Members, when this bill was in its previous committee, which was the, which committee?
Agriculture and
when
Veterans.
It was in the Ag Committee, there was an amendment that was added to the bill that in between the bill and engrossing did not make it to the first engrossment. And so as a courtesy to Senator Ropes, we are going to Senator Erickson Ropes, was this amendment not even offered?
No, we did some other technical amendments, and I overlooked this one, so we need to put this amendment before
okay,
this
so this
committee.
Okay, so this was not an engrossing oversight,
no,
but
A1.
Oversight from the of the author,
yes.
Which
yes.
happens also.
Yes. Yes.
That's a little bit iffy for this committee. Where's this bill going? It's up to the committee. This amendment is not actually in the jurisdiction of this committee, but as we know, Senator Bickerman is a member of this committee. Mm-hmm. Senator Bickerman, if if you have no objection to adding this amendment at the author's request, then since it came from your committee, I'd be willing to accept that from you.
Madam Chair, the reason, the trouble we've had out to the home, we've been trying to get somebody with expertise in health care. Not every veteran is an expert in health care. So we wanted to change it so we could get the most qualified. Sure, we'd like to have it be a veteran, but if we can't. And I think that's what we're looking at here, and I agree with that.
So, Senator Brickerman, you would be comfortable with us offering this amendment in this committee that missed getting on in your committee? Okay, so Senator Brickerman moves the A2 amendment. Senator Erickson-Ropes, would you just explain it since it is indeed not an author's amendment?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm happy to be here before you today, and I apologize for skipping over this amendment in mm-hmm. Senator Vickerman's committee. We got right to the bill, and I forgot to put the amendment out there. Senator Laurie and Senator Gims here also on the mm-hmm. Veterans Committee with me. This bill comes to me.
We need to adopt the amendment, but you need to explain it to us first, since this is not an author's amendment.
Okay, thank you. This just changes some of the language in the bill that has to do with how an executive director is selected at the for the Veterans Home Board. And as Senator Vickerman was explaining, it's becoming difficult to find executive directors and chairs of boards who are veterans, and this just gives a little bit of flexibility. There still will be preference for applicants who are veterans, but also allows some flexibility for well-qualified candidates who are non-veterans.
Is there any discussion on the A2 amendment?
Move it, Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman?
We'll move adopting the A2 amendment.
Okay, Senator Vickerman.
We're going to get things kind of, shouldn't say straightened out. We're going to get things so that home is run like that. I want it and you want it.
Senator Vickerman renews his motion to adopt the A2 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have the first engrossment of Senate File 2059 as amended in front of us, and we are looking at essentially Section 1 is in the jurisdiction of this committee, and you want to explain why you were changing the membership, and how many members are you going to have on this board now?
Madam Chair, I have Dan Williams, who is the...
No, how many... I'm asking you a question. How many members are you going to have on the board now?
Nine total.
So it will still be nine, but you're just dividing them up differently. Is that correct,
yes.
Senator?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, if you want to talk to your bill.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm joined today by Dan Williams, who is the president of the...
Vice chair
of the Veterans Home Board. And he will explain the bill and the reason that we need to make a few changes.
Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself, and we really only need you to talk to the first section. That is, why change in the membership to the board is needed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Dan Williams, Vice Chair of the Minnesota Veterans Home Board. Change in the language here does a couple of things. One, it will require that the chair of the Veterans Home Board be a veteran. Currently, that is not the case. Also, it would allow for the structure of the Veterans Home Board to have members with policy formulation and professional health experience, and certainly members with activity in veteran service organizations, congressionally chartered veteran service organizations. The reason for this is the bill in total also asked for the executive director we remove the requirement of the executive director be a veteran, while that would remain a preference. With that, we're asking for the chair of the board to be a veteran, to add that as a requirement, so we keep focus on the veterans. The number of board members would remain nine.
I understand
continue
that.
Continue to be appointed by the governor. The governor would continue to appoint the chair, but the makeup, again, has policy formulation and, the public members, correct.
I understand. Senator Erickson-Robes, we usually don't look to putting a allowing a legislator to designate someone to serve in their stead who is not an elected official of their own rank. However, since the legislator themselves here are non-voting members, I'm just bringing that to the attention of a committee, and if you want to know if you have any problem with that, because the chair's designee or the chair of the committee that deals with those issues in both bodies could possibly designate someone who is not a legislator. Is that a problem? Since they're non-voting? Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition of Senate File 2059? Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Erickson-Robes, or Mr. Williams. On line 11, page 1, line 11, it looks like we're absolutely clarifying that the chair must be designated by the governor. I'm wondering if there's a circumstance that it seems clear, that the current law seems clear to me. I'm just curious why the who must be designated by the governor, if there's an issue that required that language to be brought forward.
Sir. Chair, Senator Larson, the current state, the chair is designated by the governor. That was just a wording change, who must be. The letter and the intent of it remains the same.
So there's Senator Larson, I think he's saying it's just they thought it would read better.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just don't know if I've seen it stated that way in the bills, and that's fine, but it seemed to me that maybe there was a reason behind it, so apparently there isn't. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Again, is there anyone who wants to testify either in favor or in opposition to this bill? If not, Senator Bickerman moves that Senate File 2059, as represented by the first engrossment and as amended, be recommended to pass. All who may be in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
To the floor. All those opposed, please say no. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, where would this bill go?
It goes to the floor, Senator.
Right to the floor.
Bickerman, it doesn't need to go to another
committee.
There's
kind of an urgency here when we're trying to get everything under control.
I understand. So. It's going to the floor.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Erickson-Robes. Okey-dokey. Senator Workin. Senator Workin brings us a task force.
Thank you,
Senate
Madam Chair.
Senate File 2064, the first engrossment.
Madam Chair, that's exactly what I'm bringing you, and I'm going to croak my way through it here, so please forgive the voice.
Okay, so we're interested in how your task force meets our guidelines.
That's right. And, Madam Chair, I have the A3 amendment.
That's going to take care of the whole thing, right?
We went through your entire sheet of paper and found the pieces we needed, and that's what the A3 is all about.
Okay. Senator Larson moves the A3 amendment. This is not the committee of origin.
That's
and
correct.
Senator Worgen, because of your voice, I'm going to ask Mr. Bodern to take us through how this amendment meets the guidelines, if you would, sir.
Madam Chair and members, there are a couple of things the amendment does that are not directly related to the guidelines. The first two items on the A3 amendment on page 1, lines 2 and 3, where special is deleted, basically expand the scope of review to, as opposed to simply the special education system, it's the entire education system as I understand it.
Oh. Mr. Browder,
and Madam Chair, I'm kind of reviewing this quickly. I actually didn't draft it. It was handed to me
Madam Chair,
I walked in here.
Senator Wergen?
I can do that for you if you'd like. The reason special is deleted is because it was redundant.
Yeah, I see that.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so we wanted to take the redundancy out. It's just children with disabilities, which is the same as special education.
Yes.
Then, Madam Chair, if you look on page 1, line 4 of the amendment, that simply provides a, I believe that's a deadline for appointment of the members. It clarifies that they are all appointed by the Commissioner of Education by July 1st, 2007. And then 13, say line 6 of the amendment where you're adding language on line 13. Bill. That's actually the language that clarifies the Commissioner of Education appoints the task force members. And line 8 of the amendment, where leading line 8, bill of page 4. This, I believe, is designed to clarify exactly how legislative appointments work, as opposed to being made by the respective chairpersons, as you'll see in the first endorsement of the bill. Senate members are won by the majority, which for the House. See the additional language on the two lines of the, or three lines of the amendment, providing that the task force must select its chair at the first meeting and providing per diem and expenses.
Madam Chair.
Senator Wergen, does this task force have an expiration?
Yes, it does, Madam Chair. That's in the bill as it was written, and it is
January 30th, 2008.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
One of the things that we have done, because when there is a report that's done, is instead, because sometimes the report might not get done exactly on time, is to make the expiration of the task force coincide with the report that's made to the legislature. And I wonder if that would be agreeable to you.
Madam Chair, that's no problem at all.
And then if they, you know, if it got to be February 2nd and they were still working, they could still be in operation, even if they had missed the deadline for the original report.
Madam Chair, that's an excellent suggestion. At the Education Policy Committee meeting yesterday, there was a great deal of interest in this bill. And it's not going to be an easy task to accomplish. So that's a wonderful thing to do. Thank you.
Mr. Bodern, how would we go about doing that?
Madam Chair and members, on page 2,
well,
line
I guess, first of all, we should probably adopt the A3 amendment. Senator Gimsey moves the A3 amendment. We've had it explained. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Now we're going to fix the reporting and the expiration so that they don't get caught. So, Mr. Bodern, what would we do here?
Madam Chair and members, on page 2, line 1 of the bill, delete everything following expiration and insert the task force expires the day following submission of the report required by subdivision 4.
Everybody understand the reasoning for that? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails. Who made that motion? Senator Gimsey. The motion prevails, and the Gimsey amendment is adopted. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 2064, the first engrossment as amended? Seeing none, Senator Gimsey moves that Senate File 2064, the first engrossment as amended, be recommended to pass. and go to the Rules Committee, be referred to the Rules Committee because it has legislators on it.
And, Madam Chair, it will also subsequently yes. have to go to Finance, just so you know that.
Finance first.
All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling. Senator Pappas.
Oh,
you're up again.
I'll figure the time.
I'm going to be finished with all these bills. No.
How about Senate File 1791?
1791, Mr. Edwards is going to join me.
We have Senator Pappas' bill, the first engrossments, Senate File 1791, and we have an amendment.
Madam Chair, I have an A5 amendment. Mr. Bonner.
Let's see, I have it as an A6.
Oh.
We have an updated amendment to your A5, which is A6, and we will get you a copy.
All right. And I think Mr. Bonner did it as a delete all, but really it was just because some of the structure was changed.
Is it a delete all? It doesn't look like it
is. Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, actually, it occurred to me we didn't need to delete all, so this simply deletes the old Section 3 and provides the new language for Section 3 that you saw in the A5 amendment.
So this is a page in line, Senator Pappas, for
the section that you're concerned about
A6.
Is really the advisory task force. So.
And it is the amendment, but since it's not an author's amendment, we'll need you to take us through it, and I'm assuming the bill is here because of the task force, so we just need to make sure that it meets the guidelines, and if you'd point out how it does that, then we can act on it quickly.
Madam Chair, just the overall goal of the bill is to provide students as well as teachers with a broader understanding of the unique nature of American Indian tribal sovereignty, and it's the second part of the bill which creates the task force that is in the A6 amendment. And this task force is going to include American Indian educators, the Department of Ed, State Board of Teaching, Education Minnesota, Minnesota School Board members, and this task force will make recommendations as to the most effective way to incorporate the history and contributions of Minnesota American Indian tribes and communities into the state's K-12 standards. And, Madam Chair, let's see, the changes that we made, I believe, were on 134, the commissioner shall complete appointments to the task force by September 1st.
Okay, if you could just take us through how it meets the guidelines just to start with, starting with subdivision 2 of the amendment.
I'm working on
on line 118.
Yeah, I don't know that there how the guidelines apply to the membership.
Well,
just says who
Senator
shall appoint.
Pappas, it's like, who's the appointing authority? Well, the Commissioner of Education is the appointing authority, so that takes care of guideline 3 and so on.
Okay,
yeah.
So the Commissioner of Education is the appointing authority. That's in subdivision 2. Okay, in subdivision 3, it says when the Commissioner shall complete the appointments by September 1st. It says that on 2-1, the Commissioner of Education or her designee shall convene the first meeting. And the task force shall select a chair from its membership at the first meeting. And then it also talks about vacancies and compensation of members, and that the commissioner shall provide the task force with administrative and clerical support. And on 2-8, when the task force has to report its recommendations to the appropriate legislative committees. And that when this task force expires on 2-14. Is there anything we missed?
I think that, Mr. Bodern, addresses the guidelines. One of the things, by the way, Senator Pappas, that I have been discussing with some members and with council is we often ask these groups to make recommendations, and what we really would like to see is whether some implementing legislation that reflects the recommendations. And I wonder if you would mind in this bill, since those looks like they're going to be extensive recommendations, that they take the form not only of recommendations but suggested implementing legislation and to add that after line 2.9, after the word recommendations.
That would be fine, Ms. Madam Chair.
So, Mr. Bodern, that would be inserting after the word, and Senator Pappas will make this motion to amend. Inserting after the word recommendations, the task force must report recommendations and suggest implementing legislation to the legislative commissions and committees and divisions with jurisdiction, et cetera. You've heard Senator Pappas's motion to amend. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the Pappas motion to amend, please, to amend the A6 amendment, this is an amendment to the amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment to the amendment is adopted. We now have the A6 amendment to the first engrossment before us. Is there further discussion on the A6 amendment? Did your witness want to testify or just be available for questions?
Yes. Okay.
Are there questions or comments for Senator Pappas? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak to Senate File 1791, either in support or in opposition? Seeing none, we have Senate File 1791. Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 1791, the first engrossment, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance.
Is there a fiscal note, Madam
There's
Chair?
Compensation for the members.
Chair, I just wanted to point out on 2.5 that the compensation is subject to the availability of appropriations. I don't know if it makes a difference.
Madam Chair, I guess that's a judgment call. I think the way this is worded, it's clear it wouldn't require a new appropriation. It's maybe another way of saying if the agency wishes to compensate the task force.
They have to eat it.
Yes.
Senator Pappas, I think because of that wording, the bill would not have to go to finance. Is there anybody who objects to that on the committee? That understanding and that advice from counsel? Seeing none, Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 17 renews her motion, that Senate File or changes her motion, that Senate File 1791, the first engrossment as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Pappas. Senator Roebling, are you back? Okay. Senator Pappas, we'll take your next bill.
Madam Chair, and I do have, I think, two amendments. A1 and the A2 amendment.
And this is this is the first stop for this bill, so these are author's amendments to Senate File 1302, which is an agency initiative. Senator Pappas moves the A1 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Pappas, you have the
A2 amendment?
I don't have it. That's why I'm waiting for it. The A2 amendment, has this been distributed to members?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Members have the A2 amendment. It's a little bit lengthy, but it is an author's amendment, and it will be explained in the context of the bill. Senator Pappas moves the A2 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the A2 amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 1302 before us in the shape that the author wants. So, Senator Pappas, would you explain the bill, why it's here, and in particular, the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have Mr. Judd Shetland from the Met Council here in case I get this wrong. Okay. But what the council is proposing to do is a one-time allocation of no more than $1 million from the council's livable communities demonstration account this year to its local government comprehensive planning grant and loan program. And that's what the A1 amendment and the original bill does. And then with the A2 amendment is we are, with that amendment, permitting the Metropolitan Council to establish a nonprofit private parks foundation to supplement public tax dollars in the acquisition of land for regional parks in the metropolitan area. Madam Chair, I think this is really very, both of these things are very important and very significant. I know that we've run into in the bonding committee, there's a desire to purchase new land, park land, and it's often in conflict with a desire for operation or improvement funds for the existing parks. So by setting up a foundation, we hope that we might be able to leverage more private money in terms of the land purchase. And the first part of the bill in terms of the one-time allocation for local governments is it's time for local governments to update their comprehensive plans, and this would allow the Met Council to give them some money to help them do that.
Okay. On the Section 3 of the A2 amendment, Mr. Shetland, when we, actually Senator Bickerman and I, had a joint task force when I was in the House on the ability of local governments, and in this instance the Metropolitan Council is a local government, we put in a prohibition against local governments setting up nonprofit corporations unless they had special legislation. And then, in addition, we had part of the statute set up the conditions under which not-for-profit corporations that had previously been set up by local governments, the conditions under which, after sometime in 1997, they could continue to operate. And it included things like being subject to the open meeting law and on and on and on. Does the Subdivision 1 speak to all of those requirements, and would you explain how?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
do you understand my question?
I do. And thank you, Senator Pappas, for carrying this bill. I appreciate being before the committee. Madam Chair, I do believe that under the Subdivision 1 of Section 3 that is covered under that. All the questions that you asked for as far as how nonprofits are basically created and how they operate is covered under that section. I would look to Senate Council to concur with that, or else correct me if I am wrong.
Mr. McGowan, are they subject to everything that the pre-1997s are subject to in this?
Madam Chair, that may be the intent, but it's not.
It's
not
there. Yeah.
Obvious. So I would suggest an amendment at the end of 1.28.
Okay.
And that would simply read that the foundation is subject to the application of other laws. Provision of Minnesota Statute Section 465.719, Subdivision 9. That would make clear that they are subject to
all of those provisions.
Laws.
And this is to make sure that they are transparent, that they are they don't have special privileges that the authority that created them doesn't have, so that they can't mask their activities. Do you understand, Mr. Shetland?
Madam Chair, I absolutely understand,
okay.
and
Senator
I appreciate
Pappas, is that agreeable?
Yes. Madam Chair, I'd make that motion.
Senator Pappas moves, and Mr. McGowan, if you would read that language again.
Madam Chair, the amendment would be page 1, or on the amendment, page 1, line 28 of the amendment, after the period insert, the foundation is subject to the application of other laws provisions of Minnesota Statute Section 465.719, Subdivision 9.
Okay, are there any questions about the intent of this additional amendment to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, we have Senator Pappas's motion to amend the A2 amendment previously adopted. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment to the A2 amendment previously adopted is also adopted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Larson.
Madam Chair, and I was working on something different, so yeah. If we've dealt with this, please let me know. In the A2 amendment, I know that there's a purpose section that I know we usually don't allow to get out of here. And so.
Right. Senator Pappas, Mr. Shetland, is there a compelling reason? Sometimes we do need them, but is there a compelling reason for Section 2 of the A2 amendment?
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, I think that was a statement that was trying to be made, and I don't think it actually has to be there if you'd like to take it out.
Senator Larson moves to delete Section 2 of the A2 amendment previously adopted.
Good call.
It's just for us to all read right now.
Just made the statute shorter. Any discussion of that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment to the previously adopted A2 amendment to delete Section 2, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment to the amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion of that? Mr. Shetland.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Going back to the first amendment that was adopted, I would like to state that AMM, the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, which is now Metro Cities, is very supportive of that as well, and I wanted to make sure that the committee knew that the association that deals with the metropolitan communities is very supportive of that, and we appreciate their support and yours as well.
Okay. Is there further discussion or comment, question for Senator Pappas or Mr. Shetland? Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I had a question myself on page 2 of the A2 amendment, the report section. The council is preparing and submitting a report to the legislature, and it says, as provided in Minnesota statutes. I didn't get a chance to look up those Minnesota statutes. I wonder if that needs to be more specific than just
Mr.
the legislature.
Mr. McGowan, what is Section 3.195?
Madam Chair, that deals with reports to the legislature. I'm not exactly sure what it says, but I could check.
What about changing that to submit to the chairs of the committees with jurisdiction over local government?
Okay.
Mr. McGowan?
I'm sure that would certainly work.
Okay, we're going to change. Senator Pappas will move to amend Senate file 1302, the A2 amendment previously adopted, by on line 226, deleting legislature as provided in Minnesota Statute Section 3195 and inserting chairs of the legislative committees with jurisdiction. This is a policy issue. With jurisdiction over local government. I guess we could add legislative committees and divisions with jurisdiction over local government. We have the Pappas, motion to amend the previously amended A2 amendment. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment to the A2 amendment is adopted. Anything further, Senator Pappas? Anybody in the audience wish to speak either in favor or in opposition to the Senate File 1302 as amended? Senator Pappas then moves that Senate File 1302 as amended be recommended to pass. Any further discussion of that motion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Pappas. Senator Roebling?
Madam Chair, I'm having an amendment drafted that isn't quite ready yet. So
okay.
If I could delay a little, I'd appreciate it.
Do we know if Senator Anderson is going to be able to join us? Just say yes or no. We don't know. Okay. Well, if she doesn't get here, we'll just
keep going.
It'll be just too bad.
Somebody can go.
Sorry, but it'll be too bad. But we do have a couple of other bills. My bill folder's here.
Two.
My bill folder's here.
Oh, yes.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1393 is the first one. Was first heard in the Committee on Education, and it comes to this committee because it directs the Commissioner of Education to amend Minnesota rules to make them consistent with the Minnesota statutes that will require to be consistent in specifying that, including the specifications, I'm just reading it actually, that provide for the basis for withdrawing Department of Education approval for supplemental education service providers who fail to increase the students that they've been working with their academic proficiency for two consecutive years. And this applies not only to outside service providers, but also to school districts that take on the supplemental service providers. And this was part of a recommendation, quite frankly, that came earlier from the a report done by the Legislative Auditor's Office. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1393, and I believe it comes to us unamended, be recommended to pass.
Well, here, Senator Rust's motion. Any comments from the
let's see.
Members?
Senate Counsel, I have a note from the first committee that it was amended. Is that not your understanding? I don't see an amendment here.
You're working on the first engrossment.
Yeah.
What's
do we have an engrossment or do we have this is a bill?
We have a first engrossment.
I'm sure we're working on the first.
Hey, I don't have a first engrossment in my bill.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, then I would move the Senate File 1393, as reflected by the first engrossment, be recommended to pass.
Everyone's heard Senator Rust's motion. Any comments from the chair, from the members? Anyone from the audience care to speak either for or opposed to this bill? Hearing none, all in favor of the motion, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senate File 2126.
Senate File 2126 is also an issue that was presented in the Transportation Committee, and it will be included in that bill, reflected by the amendments that we offer to it. And the bill also needs to go to the it only has to go to the floor following here, because it does not it does not designate legislators.
Okay. And you have
unless council has a different recommendation.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Senator Rest. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Does it have to go to rules?
Because we're only at 20. This bill, after we amend it in terms of the makeup of the body, can go to the floor.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, that's correct. It does not call for the appointment of legislative members.
It does not call for the appointment of legislators. So, just briefly, what the task force is designed for is currently the Department of Transportation and others. Stakeholders are involved in coming up with a proposal to the Urban Partnership Agreement, which is a program set up by the federal government, Department of Transportation, and President Bush to spend over $1 billion in projects around the country in metropolitan areas who will be submitting proposals that are generally, purpose of which is to reduce congestion. Each one of the proposals needs to have a congestion pricing element to it. It needs to have a technology element. It needs to have a transit element and a telecommuting element in the overall proposal being made to the federal government. This particular task force will be involved in those discussions, and is set up by five people three people appointed by the Subcommittee on Committees, two of whom must live in the metropolitan area, three members appointed by the House of Representatives, the same requirement, and then six members appointed by the governor, at least three of whom may live in the metropolitan area. We've been working on the language of this congestion task force with the Citizens League. Mr. DeVore, your senior policy advisor, is here representing them, and also with the Department of Transportation with regard to the membership and the duties of the task force. And as far as I know, all issues have been resolved. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would move that amendment.
Senator Rust moves the A3 amendment. Any members have any questions?
And the A3 amendment reflects the change actually
that
in
you just described.
The numbers and the membership, right?
Yep. And you described the bill with the amendment.
With the
attached.
Amendment on it, so
everybody understand. All in favor of the Senator Rust motion to adopt the A3 amendment? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. You've already described the bill. Now, does it meet all of the guidelines?
I believe so.
Does it?
Let's check.
Isn't it supposed to have a sunset date?
I don't know.
That's one item.
Close the first meeting.
Good question. Doesn't happen. Mr. Bodden?
Commissioner shall call the meeting the first meeting. First meeting.
Great going on this side.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, is the question right now is whether there's a sunset date? Is that?
Yes.
I don't believe it has one. I think that's correct. I can add that.
Mr. DeBoer is here, and perhaps we did go through the issue of the
My name is Bob DeBoer. I'm Director of Policy Development for the Citizens League. This task force is envisioned to be in place as long as the urban partnership agreement through the implementation and any kinds of transportation changes. So that would be a three-year period at the most. So we could have a sunset in three years. And that would take that. Then we would be sure we'd be covering the whole period that would be envisioned to be in place.
Mr. Bodden, could you draft that
Senator
amendment,
Council?
Quickly?
Sure. Madam, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I think what you'd want then is on page 2, after line 4, you can insert a new subdivision 3 expiration date. The task force expires August 1st, 2010.
Senator Rest moves the oral amendment as read by Mr. Bodden. Everyone understand the motion? Any questions? All in favor of this motion? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to get a copy. Just to be certain of the language, I want to have the engrossed copy. I have the amended copy in my file, but not the engrossed one. Just going to give it to me. Just one second. And then, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 2126, as presented in the first engrossment and amended, be recommended to pass, with also the added comment that I will be asking the Senate Transportation Chair to put that sunset date on the provision as it's been included in the Transportation Policy Bill as well.
Everyone heard and understand Senator Rust's motion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Senator?
On the issue of the Rules Committee, I think that the intention of the Rules, it requires that any bill appointing legislators would have to go to the Rules Committee. I think the intention there was just so that they can keep track of who they're supposed to be appointing. So even though literally the rule would not require this to go, Senator Rust, you may want to just advise them to watch this bill so that they remember they're both supposed to make some appointments.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzel, point well taken. Yeah. We're looking for the legislature's involvement to be with public members, but we certainly will make sure that they're advised of that.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest. Maybe a question for Mr. DeBoer, and maybe this is a little outside our committee's jurisdiction, but I do have the question as it relates to the timetable for the application to be submitted. And the reason I ask is I was at a 35W Solutions Alliance meeting this morning, and a lot of the stakeholders in the end of the metro that I am that I represent are, I would be fair to say, are not entirely enthusiastic about the direction which the department is moving with its current draft proposal, and so I'm concerned with how much input the appointees are going to have, and hoping that we're getting this done fast enough so that process plays out.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Larson, that certainly is our hope. The preliminary application is indeed due April 30th.
April 30th, and
we're hoping that as that, you know, that's the preliminary one, and as we move forward, that this group would be able to have a real bully pulpit to influence the decisions that are being made by the Department of Transportation with regard to this project. And certainly it is not without a lot of active discussion. I don't know that I would characterize it as controversy, but certainly active discussion about what would be the best corridor for such a project to be the for us to be the applicant for.
Well, Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Rest, and I understand that, and I hope that there is, and it sounds like there is a second phase to the application process that allows us to improve MnDOT's submission. I think that'll be important. I think what I was clearly hearing this morning is that some of the concern is that the proposals aren't aggressive enough, and we will not be considered for those federal dollars. And I'm concerned about that. And I think that members should, be concerned about that as it relates to their own corridors, as I know you are, Madam Chair.
So thank you, Senator Larson. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 2126, the first engrossment, be as amended, be recommended to pass.
Everyone understand Senator Rust's motion. Any further questions? Anyone from the audience care to speak either for or opposed to this bill? Hearing none, all in favor, aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senate File 1812.
Didn't even see the back here. Is everybody here? Okay. Mr. Chairman, I want to delay taking up
1966.
1812. One of the testifiers, the witnesses, is on his way, but not yet here, and take instead Senate File 1966.
Works just fine. Senate File 1966.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1966 is provisions that propose changes to the charitable gambling statutes. It makes some very modest changes. And I have an amendment. It is the A1 amendment.
This is the first this bill's been heard, so this would be an author's amendment, correct? So Senator Rust moves the A1 amendment. All in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the bill is actually very short, and it has, I think the major provision deals with the bingo provisions. We made some changes in previous session with other forms of charitable gambling, and inadvertently did not include bingo in that, in those expense caps. And so we are clarifying that they indeed would be included as well. Section 2 allows for licensed commercial products that be themed, pull tab games and allows then charitable gambling organizations to have games that are similar to the lottery games that are currently being allowed. And in Section 3, we are making changes that are dealing with linked bank bingo, which we have been addressing, I think, almost every year. Something comes up that we need to be changing it since 2003, and that's in Section 3, Subdivisions 1 and 1A, and Section 4. And then Section 3 allows for pull tabs to be sold for up to $5, giving the charitable organizations more flexibility in the way in which games are put together. The previous cap was $2, and the lottery is also able to have games that are that have a higher cap as well. And so we are proposing to allow the charitable gambling organizations to have the same standard. And Mr. Wilson is here to answer questions or speak to the bill.
Members have questions. Questions? Senator Vickerman?
Madam Chair, on page 3, I noticed you changed them all $2, but you have one paddle ticket be no more than $2. Is there a reason for that? Or maybe should they all be $5? Or I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wilson. Vickerman, that's
introduce
something.
Introduce yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry, King Wilson, Executive Director of Allied Charities of Minnesota. We actually talked about that in looking at raising all of them, and the paddle wheel is a particular game, and we talked to the one main distributor that uses that game, and they preferred to keep it at $2, and that made, we talked about it, and it just made sense on that particular game to leave it at $2 because that's worked well and doesn't need to be higher, but the other two we decided to change.
And Mr. Wilson, I see another one in here that
Senator Vickerman.
I went on page 2 on the top of page 2, subdivision 6B. I think if I'm not mistaken, I looked in the paper here a while back, and there's some problem with the lottery tickets looking just like another ticket. Is that kind of what we're looking at here? On
Mr. Chair, Senator Vickerman. The commercial products, right now we've had some distributors, manufacturers, charities that would like to do some themed type games that would, one of our distributors was going to want to do a kind of a made in Minnesota, and they were going to use a Polaris snowmobile, they were going to use a can of Spam, and they went to the control board and it was kind of like good idea, but the problem is we have language that prevents commercialization, so by saying that, by giving the board the permission, we'll be able to do that. Our friends at the lottery have done games themed around the Minnesota Twins, Harley Davidson, and we just thought it might be something that by being able to use some licensed products that it would allow us to have something that the consumer might want to purchase.
One last question, Mr. Chair. You know how I feel about gambling. I'm going to support this as long as it stays within this context. Not simulcasting and not horse tracking, trotting, and all that kind of stuff. So if you do, I'm going to get on the floor and I'm going to react to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Vickerman, our hope is to keep it to charitable gambling. We know in the House they're calling it an omnibus charitable gambling bill, and it is their hope, I believe, as well, not to open it up to other things other than charitable gambling-related areas.
Thank you. Before we get too far off this topic, I'll come back to you in 1 minute. You said that prior law restricted the commercial products. Should there be a repealer for that? I don't see any.
Chair, one of the kind of the mission statements of the board is to prevent the commercialization of gambling, just commercial gambling, the integrity of gaming. And we don't believe that it was meant that being able to use that, but because we don't have something that allows us to do these types of games, we thought that other than those other things that we needed to do it in this particular area, and that's why we limited it to the approval of these games. But We thought of deleting the commercialization part of the mission, but then we thought that's pretty broad, and there might be some things, and both the board and I, that the industry worked and came up with this language, which would allow us to do what we wanted to do to begin with.
Thank you. Senator Larson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Wilson, can you just touch on the repealer and why that's necessary? And if
Mr. Chairman, Senator Larson, this comes as a recommendation from the Charitable Gambling Board that there's no need to have two separate accounts of the charities, one for bingo and one for non-bingo. So that's what's being repealed, the requirement that they have two separate accounts. And I might add that as far as I understand, the Charitable Gambling Board is satisfied with this with this legislation and has no objection to it.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Rest moves Senate File 1966 as amended.
Recommended to pass.
Mm-hmm. Anyone from the audience care to speak either for or opposed to this bill? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Back to this commercial product issue. If you use somebody's logo or their commercial image, do you have to get permission to do that so that you don't get into trouble for reproducing that?
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, the answer would be yes. I believe the board, if a game came before that had the Minnesota Twins or Harley-Davidson, they would be asking that the manufacturer, before it be approved, would be able to show that they had some sort of a licensing agreement with that particular company or entity.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, and that is exactly what occurred between the lottery and the Minnesota Twins.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, all in favor of Senator Rest's motion? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is anybody here ready for their bill?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Rest.
Next bill.
You ready for 1812?
Is Senate File. Beg pardon?
1812?
Is 1812. And this is a bill that proposes to discretionary authority to the Hennepin County and to the city of Minneapolis to merge their library systems into one. And I have two amendments. One is the A3 amendment, which is an author's amendment.
Seeing that it's an author's amendment, all in favor of does everybody have the A3 amendment? All in favor of this amendment? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to find.
You have another
article.
Two.
Okay, in Article 2, Section 3. Page 9, I want to delete on line 914 to delete 10 and insert 11.
That's an author's amendment as well. All in favor of Senator Rest's amendment? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman and members, the metropolitan area, and in particular in Hennepin County, has had two premier library systems for decades. In recent years, there has been become an issue with the funding support from the city of Minneapolis to be able to carry on their library system independently and keep the premier service that their residents have become accustomed to.
Senator Russ, can you pull the microphone
sure.
a little closer to us?
And as a result of those concerns, there began to be discussions among the two library boards. The Minneapolis Library Board is elected. The Hennepin County Library is Library Board is appointed. Discussions among the elected officials, in addition to the Minneapolis Library Board members from the Hennepin County yeah. Board of Commissioners and the Minneapolis City Council. This proposal has come as a result of those discussions. The two library boards have passed resolutions in support of merging their systems into a system to be known as the Hennepin County Library System or Hennepin Library System. And the city councils and most recently the Hennepin County Board have adopted resolutions in support of moving forward with this discretionary authority for them to merge the systems. So that is what we have before you today in concept, and there are representatives from the various systems and elected bodies to come and talk about the legislation and why it is needed. I think they're here.
Somebody like to come up? Please introduce yourself for the record and offer your testimony.
They came in after I had turned my back.
I thought you were starting to see things.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm Peter McLaughlin. I am Hennepin County Commissioner and co-chair of our intergovernmental committee. I am pleased to be here tonight. As Senator Rest indicated, we have had two premier library systems operating within Hennepin County for decades. It is our hope that with this bill, we are going to receive the authority to create one premier library system for the 21st century. And we believe that after many discussions that the combining of the two systems, which have in fact have been quite complementary to one another and they've worked very closely together, but that the combining of the two systems will help assure the kind of collection, the kind of access to technology, the kind of long-term stable financing that will produce the 21st century library system for all the residents of our county. We have had two committees that have worked on this. I'll speak to the county committee. We created a committee on the future of libraries in Hennepin County with representation from the city of Minneapolis, from Hennepin County. And that committee unanimously adopted some guiding principles which are reflected in the bill before you. And our own library board, which is advisory to the Hennepin County Board, has endorsed the concept of the combining of the two systems. We have tried in this bill to make sure that we sort of take the decisions that have been made in the past by the two separate library systems with their own separate taxing jurisdiction, Minneapolis and the balance of Hennepin County, that the decisions of the past would be the responsibility of the taxpaying jurisdiction that made those decisions, but that future decisions would be part of this combined library system, Hennepin County-wide. And we think we have navigated that. We've negotiated that very, very closely. As with any merger, it's complicated. We think we've covered most of the complications. There are, I think it's fair to say, still some issues to be dealt with in terms of employer relations, and we are working on those, and we are very hopeful that we can come to an agreement on that. But, Mr. Chairman, we think this is a step, Matt and members of the committee, a step that will help to stabilize and improve library services in the largest county in the state of Minnesota. This would give us the authority to negotiate out the final details and allow us to move forward. So we ask for the support of this committee and the legislature as we move forward. We've had great cooperation with the city of Minneapolis and the library board in Minneapolis. I want to say that for the record. It's been a very fruitful discussion, one that's been kind of kicked around for a number of years, and I think we finally come to a good place on this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
And members of the committee, my name is Barbara Johnson. I'm president of the Minneapolis City Council, and I'm joined by two of my colleagues from the City Council, Councilmember Sandy Colvin-Roy and Councilmember Betsy Hodges. And Councilmember Colvin-Roy served on the Library Future of Libraries in Hennepin County Committee with Commissioner McLaughlin and myself, and Councilmember Hodges, who's the chair of our Intergovernmental Relations Committee, served on the Library Advisory Committee. We are, as a city, committed to this merger. We have great challenges with funding in our library system. This offers an opportunity for more stable funding and more equitable services for our citizens in Minneapolis. We have unique features in our Minneapolis library which provide service to people across the state and even the region. We have the only patent library in the region. We also have a historical collection which is not replicated elsewhere. We think that that facility and those services deserve to be supported by a larger tax base. We currently have a governmental system that does not provide for the best accountability. Operational decisions are made by the library board, and funding decisions are essentially done at the city council level. That has not been a model that has worked well in the most recent past with some of the issues that we've had with local government aides. We think that a merger will give us increased efficiencies over time, and that we will be able to reopen our libraries. We've made a commitment to reopen the three libraries that have been closed as part of this approval. And that will establish a baseline of service that will be at the level that it was before the libraries were closed. We feel that the county's more rapidly expanding tax base offers a brighter future for the libraries in Hennepin County and in Minneapolis in particular. So we are delighted that this is moving forward. As Commissioner McLaughlin said, we are committed to resolving the issues that remain, but we think this is a great step forward for the citizens of Hennepin County, and we look forward to your approval and ask for your support. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. State your name and offer your
good
testimony.
Evening. I'm Anita Ducor, and I'm president of the Minneapolis Public Library Board. Mr. Chair and fellow committee members, good evening. The recent vote to take the next step toward the consolidation of the Hennepin County and Minneapolis Public Libraries by the Hennepin County Board was an important and historic decision. For more than 40 years, our communities have tried to bring together these two significant educational institutions to better serve our citizens. They are complementary and supportive in their missions. One has an extraordinary contemporary collection, and it is a circulating giant compared to other library systems around the country. The other claims a significant historic and archival collection, as well as the wealth of databases and electronic resources that is a treasure to the state. To create the best library system to serve more than a quarter of our state's population, we need to bring the Hennepin County and Minneapolis Public Library systems together. In their vote on Tuesday, the Hennepin County Commissioners adopted a set of guiding principles that are wise and profound in the guidance they offer to the consolidation process. However, the county board added specific language on employment and compensation that allows the consolidation effort to move forward while we resolve important labor-related issues. That was a move in the right direction. The Minneapolis Public Library Board is absolutely committed to a consolidation effort that protects all MPL employees. This is not an issue of if, but how that will be done. We believe that the guiding principle of economic fairness for all MPL employees can be accomplished. I urge this committee to approve the bill tonight so that the important and historic effort of bringing together these two library systems can continue while we take the time to need to also resolve the economic issues before us. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, I don't think there's anybody likes libraries more than I do. Been involved in libraries way back when I was a county commissioner. We put together the Plum Creek bookmobile that drives around in rural Minnesota. When I took over as commissioner, the one before it didn't want to fund it. I funded it, and everybody went to the library. So I think you should have any of them closed if you can figure out a way to keep them open. My concern is, and maybe I'm way off base, what about the employees? Have you got it figured out so that, that you're taking care of them? Because I don't, like Senator Stump said today, I don't need any phone calls.
Senator Russ.
Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons that there has been some real caution in moving forward is to make sure that the employees of both systems are protected. And there certainly are some differences in the contracts and the compensation that is given to employees of one system and the other. And there have been ongoing discussions, and there will continue to be ongoing discussions until it's resolved. However, Mr. Chairman, I have two other author's amendments that I would like to offer. One of them, indeed, does deal with protection of employees. This is not something, the language in this amendment is not something that is totally universally agreed on at this point. However, it puts the language in the bill so that we can have continue to have further further discussions and without impinging on the rights of employee groups as they bargain with either system. And so, Mr. Chairman, as an author's amendment, I have the A2 amendment.
That's being passed around now. Since it's an author's amendment, though, we'll just move it. All in favor of Senator Rust's motion to amend with the A2 amendment? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, that the language is wants to be out there. I want it out there in public so that we can continue to work on it. And the second one goes back to our issue of purpose language, and which we do not need. And on section one in the head note, I'd like to delete, and I think this can be done orally, delete purpose and just leave the word preemption. And then to delete lines 112 through line 117, the period. So that section 1 would read, preemption, this act supersedes any contrary Minnesota laws and provisions of the Home Rule Charter and ordinances of the City of Minneapolis. We do not need the purpose language. The language of the legislation speaks for itself as to its purpose. So that would be another author's amendment, Mr. Chairman.
That appears clear enough to me. Anyone have any questions regarding that? Seeing none, all in favor of this motion? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, then just briefly going through the bill, we talked about the reason for it, et cetera, but I'd just like to reference the sections of it very quickly. So we have the preemption language to start with in Article 1. Section 2, we have definitions. Section 3 provides for the transfer of assets between the entities that are involved. Section 4 retains to the city the rights to the library parking ramp, the library board parking ramp. Section 5 does deal with the transfer of employees, that they would be under one system. Section 6 refers to retirement fund participants and of the Minneapolis employees. Section 7 deals with the responsibilities for existing debt and unissued capital improvement bonds, particularly with relationship to the Minneapolis Public Library. Section 8 proposes how the revenues are going to be handled for the operating funds. Section 9 refers to the operation of the planetarium, which is co-located with the Central Library in Minneapolis. Section 10 transfers the functions of the library board, the Minneapolis Library Board, to the new library board. Section 11 talks about the ballpark tax levy. And I'm going to ask Commissioner McLaughlin how that impacts the operations of the libraries with regard to the ballpark legislation that was passed last year.
Mr. Chairman and members, the attempt in Section 11 is to take the policy that was adopted by the legislature and signed by the governor last year that said that if the ballpark tax were to generate excess money over and above what's necessary to retire the bonds in that particular years, that a portion of those monies, up to a total of $4 million for libraries and youth services, could be devoted to libraries. What we're trying to do with this language is to not change that policy in any way. We're just trying to have it fit with the altered merge system that would be in place. So there's no change in policy of what was adopted last year. It just would allow the money to be spent by the new merged library system, and we wanted to make sure that the entire county would benefit from those revenues should they become available.
Okay. In Section 12 of Article 1 is allows the interested parties to make the specific documents that are needed to bring about the merger, and all of Article 1 is non-codified special legislation. Article 2 involves the statutory changes that need to be made in the in Minnesota statutes, and find where. And it really does just eliminates the levy for the Minneapolis Library Board under 275065. Then Section 2 also is a reference to the library levy. Section 3 we amended in terms of the establishing this board for the merged library system. The library levy itself is now going to be levied throughout Hennepin County. Prior to that, the Hennepin County Library levy was just levied on suburban areas outside of the city of Minneapolis. Minneapolis and the Library Board levied their own levy for their system. And then the effective date occurs after all the transactional documents have been fully executed. So, Mr. Chairman, that is the proposal and the outline to allow the Hennepin County Library System and the Minneapolis Library System, operated by the Minneapolis Library Board, to effect a merger.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. McLaughlin. I understand why this is probably a benefit to the people in Hennepin County who live in Minneapolis, but I'm wondering about how you've considered the impact on the rest of the taxpayers in Hennepin County. I mean, you're really helping bail out of a system that has a lot of financial problems. And what impact is that going to have on the rest of your taxpayers?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Romley, there has been extensive discussion of that issue. I think the guiding premise and the reason that the suburban, and I'm a city county commissioner, the suburban members of the county board are supportive of this is because they have seen the two systems, in fact, are complementary. If you go along a continuum of an archival library system and a sort of popular library system. These are kind of archetypes. I think it's fair to say that Minneapolis is on the archival end of that continuum. Minneapolis has collected over the years the unique copies of certain books and other materials so that they're available countywide. In fact, they've been available statewide. There's no question about that. Hennepin County is, in terms of tendencies, has been more toward the popular collection and having more copies of popularly available materials. And that those policies have been consciously, very self-consciously adopted by the two systems. If the Minneapolis system were to become weaker and unable to fulfill its archival mission, it would change what Hennepin County had to buy. It would change our policies. We're already seeing with libraries in Minneapolis closed every Monday, we're seeing spillover into our libraries. And from the business side, Council President Johnson mentioned the patent library. The patent library is used by business people all over Hennepin County, all over the region and the state, as an important business resource. And right now, the downtown library where the patent library is situated is closed on Mondays. That's not good for business. And so on balance, we think that the two systems are complementary and we'll get more out of those two systems by bringing them together. We have looked at the tax impact, and we think that in the initial year that there is a swing of a couple hundred thousand dollars, that's the best estimate, in a budget that is in excess of $60 million for the two combined systems. That's rounding error as far as these things go. And long term, we think that the systems work together and it'll be fair for taxpayers across the county. And that's why both the suburban members of our board and the city members of our board supported the merger.
Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and a little bit to Senator Roebling's question. I don't think there's an easy answer to that question. I don't think you can just sum it up in a dollar amount. And this is an enormously complicated issue. I think that for many of the reasons that have been given to us by the testifiers, is something that needs to move forward, I think, for the long-term health of both systems. And so as someone who represents both suburban, largely suburban Hennepin County residents, and a portion of city residents, I think it's in the best interest of the total system in the long term that these systems merge. And we head down this road. I think that's going to be an issue that will be scrutinized for many years moving forward, both at the county board level and at the city level and the suburban community level as well. And so I think that issue doesn't necessarily go away. I think people will be mindful of it, but I think overall there's a general feeling that this merger is in the long-term benefit of all the residents of Hennepin County.
Any questions? Anyone from the audience care to speak, either support or opposed to this bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and offer your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Elliot Side. I'm the executive director of AFSCME Council 5. We represent 40,000 public workers and workers who serve the public throughout Minnesota. And we represent 575 of the best, hardest working library employees in both the city and the county systems. Thank you for letting me testify today. Mr. Chairman, AFSCME is very distressed by the way this has been going forward. I want to make it clear that we also have principles that support a merger. One principle is one that assures job security and no diminishment of wages for the people who've been working in the system, many of whom city library workers are sitting in the second row here tonight. Another one is that there be financial stability for the system and access for the patrons. Nobody, and I stress this, nobody cares more about the service that the patrons get than the employees who deliver those services to the public. That's the county employees, the librarians of the county, the clerical workers who assist in the county, and 175 members of AFSCME who support the library in Minneapolis. They've worked very hard in very difficult financial situations to make this library work, despite the local government aid cuts that took place to Minneapolis that resulted in huge cuts to the library system, not only this library system, but library systems throughout this state. In the city of Minneapolis library system, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, our members lost one-third of our membership through the cuts that took place in the library system, and others had their hours reduced from full-time to part-time in the crisis that took place in 2003-2004. They have paid dearly to keep that open. The beautiful downtown building in Minneapolis that's built is built on the backs and blood of those workers. Their layoffs, their reduction in hours, and that's why when it went up, there weren't enough people to serve the library. People don't come to a library for bricks and mortar. They come to a library because there are dedicated people who deliver service to them that they need. And I want to be clear about how AFSCME feels about libraries. And I've said this to people in the library system. It's the way I was brought up. It's the position of my union. You can't have democracy if you don't have a quality public library system. Quality public library system is a standard for the state of a democracy. So we believe in a quality public library system. But we are not going to agree to a merged system that merges on the backs of the workers. Our members who live in Minneapolis, who work in the Minneapolis system, make on average about $30,000 a year. A lot of them make much less than that. The last amendment that passed in this assumes a cut in wages to those workers, and somehow they'll be made whole on the come. Hennepin County Board passed principles that they said laid a foundation for merger. Commissioner McLaughlin has been working diligently to try to resolve labor relations problem, but the board passed a resolution the other day that not only doesn't lay a foundation for merger in terms of the workers who work in the system, but in fact is a poison pill for this merger. Just 20 minutes before that, they passed hundreds of millions of dollars more for billionaire owners of baseball teams and for millionaire baseball players. Meanwhile, these people who are taxpayers in Hennepin County and the city of Minneapolis are being asked to take wage cuts so that this merger can take place. Now, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I've been around this Capitol on and off since 1980. There have been a lot of public sector mergers that have taken place. We've had the county courts into the state court system, the St. Paul Public Health Department into the Ramsey County Public Health Department, the technical and community colleges into the Minnesota State Colleges and University, a merger I worked on personally with Senator Roger Moe in this august body, Metropolitan Waste Control into Metropolitan Council Environmental Services, Regional Transit Board into Metropolitan Council. Every one of those mergers worked on the same assumption. You came to the merger in the condition you were found in. You didn't take a cut in wages in order to get into the system. And after that, collective bargaining worked out all the differences in it. Now, we represent the county employees and the city employees. There's no difference of a position between them. Yes, the city employees make more in wages per hour and have a smaller work week, but they don't get retiree health insurance like the Hennepin County employees do. So you have to look at a total package. Collective bargaining was built so that people could make the trades and deal with the individual needs of the workers. And most importantly, deal with the workers in terms of the consent of those who are working. It brings workers to the table with the employer as equals at a bargaining table to work out the problems and solve the solutions. This legislation and that proposal that says it'll make people whole but assumes a cut in wages presumes an outcome that's yet to be negotiated. These workers don't deserve a pay cut to make this work. And that's what this legislation does. And that's what the county foundation principles do. I want to make it clear that we do support a merger. We think it's good public policy if the workers' wages and job security are protected. And I also want to make it very clear that we will oppose any legislation that makes a wage cut the condition of this merger. Library workers shouldn't lose their jobs, their wages, or benefit accruals as a result of the merger. The work they do today will be the same work they're doing tomorrow as part of the merger. They shouldn't be paid less for doing the same work. These folks right here, you know, take a good look at them because they're everyday heroes. They've continued to satisfy patrons' hunger for knowledge despite state cuts that force libraries to cut their workforce by a third. You can't build a stronger library system by wounding city library workers once again. It's just not right. Now, there's other aspects of this. Any one of us who's been involved in mergers, I've been involved in mergers in the public sector. My own council is a result of the merger, and I'm the employer in the council. We had some folks who were at 37 and a half hours work week, some folks who paid one wage, another wage. It's been two collective bargaining agreements to put this together. Sometimes there are upfront costs of a merger, and one of those upfront costs are the cost of the human capital sitting over here. They're not stones. They're not things. They're people. They eat. They live. They have rent to pay. And they ought not be victims in this merger to solve the problem. This legislation still makes them victims. And until it's fixed, and until we have a right to see these folks come in whole and then bargain contracts on behalf of them, this union will oppose this merger without apology and advocate for these people and their rights without apology. And I urge you to take that into consideration and not pass a merger any differently than the ones I mentioned. We did the whole court system without doing to the workers what's being done to the workers here. It's outrageous. It's shameful. And I urge you to consider that as you move forward on this piece. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Seiden. Senator Rust?
Mr. Chairman, I certainly appreciate Mr. Seiden's passion for the employees and the members of his union and the service that they render to the people of Minneapolis and in particularly the children. The reason why I offered that one amendment was to make sure that the issue that he described is on the table, even if this language in that amendment is not satisfactory. It seems to me that we cannot ignore the issues that Mr. Seiden brought forward as this bill moves forward, and everything needed to be on the table, at least in concept. So I appreciate his arguments. I think all of us are going to be very, very mindful of the compensation, the changes that will be coming about, the protections that are needed for employees of both systems, not just the Minneapolis system. And as Mr. Seiden mentioned, he represents the Hennepin County Library employees as well. And there are some employees that in one system have a representative and in the other system they are not organized. So there's even that issue that we will need to be resolved. But it needed to be a start on that, I thought, introduced in this bill as well. The bill does need to go to the Tax Committee, and it would be my recommendation as it does move forward to make sure that we address some of these issues that are still unresolved in the Tax Committee. But the issue is on the table, and it belonged to be suggested affirmatively, in my opinion, in this committee. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate file,
1812.
What's the number?
1812.
1812. Be recommended to pass and refer to Committee on Taxes.
As amended. Any other questions? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, maybe it's a question for Mr. Seiden. I'm sorry I wasn't here at the beginning, and I see the amendments he offered. This talks about compensate for any loss of wages. pursuant to a memorandum of understanding. Is there a memorandum of understanding? Maybe this is for Senator Rest. Is there one now?
No, there is not one now. And it is suggested that whatever that would be, that it would have to go along with that. It would be this, that amendment would connect with that, suggesting that at some point, whatever the agreement is, that it be controlled by a memorandum of understanding.
And Mr. Chairman,
Senator Marty.
Mr. Saad, I heard your whole presentation, and I share the concern. I don't know how you do merge them, and you said you've been involved in all those other ones, and it's worked out. Were they passed with such a thing as like this, or how was it? How were they done? How do you do it to make sure you have people made whole?
Mr. Saad.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, the basic principle, the way the other ones worked and the way this one can work, is if there are different wage rates to the folks in the different systems, different classifications, and in fact the jobs are different in terms of what folks do. There are not apples and apples comparisons just based on the title of a job classification. And the way this has worked before is that the merger begins, workers come into the system as they are. So if somebody's making $18 an hour in the Minneapolis system now and has a 37-and-a-half-hour work week, they come in and they start working for Hennepin County at $18 an hour with a 37-and-a-half-hour work week. And, yes, the county in that system has multiple systems going. Then we sit down and negotiate a contract and begin to build a new system. There are trades that have to be made. How do you go from 37-and-a-half to 40 hours and compensate for the employees for that? Will the new employees get retiree health care or not get retiree health care? What type is the work the same? There's lots of issues to be dealt with. We just dealt with that in the courts, the merger. We started out in Hennepin County and Ramsey County just with that part of the court merger with very different conditions of employment, and then negotiated the state. But what we didn't do, Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, is we didn't cut the employees' wages going into the system with some promise of some kind of compensation. If the legislature or the city or the county is interested in putting money on the table as transition for the merger, fine. Bring the people in as they are, and we'll negotiate the future. Other parts of this merger, Mr. Chairman and Senator Marty, in this document will take place over time. Why is this the one piece that has to be settled up front in a way that will hurt these employees? So the way we did these other ones is we brought the people in their current condition, and then we negotiated new terms and conditions of employment. And the great part about that is through the collective bargaining process, the workers get to sit at the table and deal with the problems that are faced and try to find solutions to the problem that may involve trade-offs between different pieces. That's, I think, the best, and I hope that's a satisfactory explanation of how that gets done.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Marty.
Mr. Saad, then in effect what you'd like is a provision instead of saying transfer must be compensated for any loss of wages, you'd like something that says they're whole until negotiations.
And let the collective bargaining process determine the outcome.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Saad, you said you represent the Hennepin County employees, too.
That's correct.
And they have one of the things, you said, apples, it's not apples to apples, they have retiree benefits and so on. And it could be when you're bargaining, there'd be one bargaining unit when you're merged. When they're doing it, they may say, well, we take the 40 hours, but we want the retiree benefits, or we drop the retirement benefits and take the 37.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly it. Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, that's exactly how one does it. And I'm just using that as an example as opposed to a real situation, but that's just an example of the trades that one makes in that situation. But the key thing is that the Minneapolis employees be brought in at the wage rates and in the working conditions they currently have, and then we'll sit down and negotiate that. In the principles that the Hennepin County Board passed, they picked and chose what was beneficial to them. They said for the purposes of wages, the workers will go into the wage system in Hennepin County. So they'll take a 6% wage cut right off the bat, and they'll work 40 hours a week with that 6% wage cut instead of 37-and-a-half hours. But for the purpose of retiree health insurance, they're all new employees, despite the fact that most of our employees have worked there. We have people who worked there 40 years, 30 years, 20 years, put their whole lives into this system, and now, and live paycheck to paycheck, you're going to have to take a 6.5% or 6% pay cut to make this merger work? $30,000 a year, ladies and gentlemen, city of Minneapolis or Hennepin County. I challenge people to live on that and pay their rent. And we're going to ask them to take a 6% pay cut up front before we even do the thing? No, the way to do it is bring them in whole as they are, and then let us bargain with the county and try to straighten this thing out, and we'll get there. In my own merger of my councils, I've done two collective bargaining agreements, and we're still working on it. Because a merger, you merge the day you merge, but merger takes place over time. And why should we treat the workers less well than we treat the buildings? I don't understand that.
Senator Marty? Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering, I serve on tax committee as well, where I guess this is going. Have you proposed language that, I mean, I don't know when this merger takes effect.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Marty, if you look at the last page of the bill, it only after all of the transactional documents have been effectuated. So there's not a date certain. The issue of the differential in the wages and compensation and benefits. Again, the reason for the author's amendment was to make sure that this issue is on the table and it's upfront. Whether this language accomplishes total equity for everyone, I wouldn't even pretend that that's the case. But it does get the issue. You in the tax committee will not be allowed not to address it, Senator Marty, and it comes to you with the issue there rather than my having to introduce the issue in the tax committee. And it seemed to me, Mr. Tsai, that it was better to do it here so that when it goes to the tax committee, it's on the table. It is not something that I have to bring to the tax committee.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Ress, you're willing to, in other words, you're saying this is the
there may be
placeholder,
even,
perhaps.
There may be other issues that need to be addressed in the tax committee that deal with some of the levy issues that have been proposed so far that are really, I went through the whole bill because this is the committee of origin, but that may need to be moderated there as well, given the advice of tax counsel and of the tax committee.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I would welcome hearing from Mr. Side and talking with Senator Rest about this by then.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would renew my motion that Senate File 1812 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Any other questions of members? So we have Senator Rest's motion before us. All in favor? Aye. Mm-hmm.
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Thank you
motion
very much.
Carries.
No.
If you want to make it.
No, I do. Surgery a month ago.
What?
Stitches when they came out. Surgery, well, stitches when they came out.
Looked like a good
label. And I got an abscess behind there, so I kind of gets the front of it. They have to pat.
It's not our fight day. Yeah, they'd be out of work.
Senator Anderson's?
Madam Chair, is it all right if I start with Senate File 1998? Because I think it's
certainly
the simpler
may.
Of the bills. Thank you. Hopefully we can.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Anderson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this is my first visit to this committee this session, and I'm wondering, would you like me to explain the bill, the policy of the bill, or just focus on the issues that relate to the jurisdiction of this committee, or?
Just what's before the committee.
Okay. This is a bill that just passed out of the Energy Committee earlier this week that essentially updates the rules related to intervener compensation, which allows nonprofit organizations to advocate on behalf of low-income people in energy rate cases. That's my summary of the policy of the bill. There are some rulemaking changes, because part of what we're doing here is taking what is currently in rules and putting it into statute. And so that's the piece that I think most directly affects the jurisdiction of this committee. And I think I'd like to ask, Section 2 relates to the application of the rules. I think I'll let Pam Marshall explain the details of how this affects current rules and future rules, because she's most familiar with that. Pam Marshall is from the Energy Sense Coalition.
Ms. Marshall. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Pam Marshall with the Energy Sense Coalition. My understanding of the way in which Section 2, or the reason for the way in which Section 2 was drafted, is because the rules pertaining to intervention in utility rate cases include not only natural gas and electric utilities, but also telephone companies. It's my understanding from Public Utilities Commission staff that there hasn't been a telephone rate case in about 20 years, but there's been several natural gas and electric rate cases in the last few years. So the point of Section 2 is to allow those rules to continue to apply to telephone companies, but to allow the commission to go through an expedited rulemaking process to conform what we're doing here in statute, which is streamlining current rules, to this provision as it's before you.
And Ms. Marshall, or Senator Anderson, is there any other place where this occurs, or is this something unique to this situation?
Madam Chair, I guess I didn't. Is what unique? This application.
Not applying. Yes, this application or lack of application of the rules.
Madam Chair, it's, again, it's my understanding that it isn't all that rare, because this was drafted differently in the House, and the reviser said, no, this is the way to do it as drafted here today.
Okay. Are there questions for Senator Anderson on the application of rules in this instance? Senator Roebling.
I guess she'll work with it. I'm just reading the bill.
Okay.
And I'm trying to.
Do you understand the. Would you like for a little bit more explanation of this intervener compensation?
Since that's the underlying bill, I'm really curious about that. I don't know that anything like that hardly occurs.
We found out in the Committee of Origin that indeed it does, and I guess I feel familiar and comfortable with it. But Senator Anderson, maybe even though our jurisdiction is only the rules, if you would give us just a little bit more background and why. Why this compensation for interveners, who it really applies to, and why it's appropriate.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Roebling, the law has been in place for many, many years, and we're not quite sure when it was first passed. At least I'm not. Certainly, it's been in place since the early 90s, we know for sure, that allows an organization, a non-governmental organization, to participate in a rate case on behalf of consumers or low-income consumers to advocate for their interest as consumers in a rate case. Now, in a rate case where the utility comes to the Public Utilities Commission and asks for the right to raise their electric or gas rates, they automatically are able to recover all of their own costs, the utility's own costs, in advocating for the rate increase. And that can be, you know, $1 million a case, in the neighborhood of that. And what we decided as a legislature many, many years ago is that it's appropriate to also allow some recovery on a very limited basis for advocacy on behalf of those consumers who will have to pay those increased rates. All of this, I mean, the utility costs are recovered from ratepayers. And so this is also a cost that's passed on to ratepayers. But under current law, it's been capped at $30,000. So it's a very – 20, I'm sorry – $20,000, so it's a very minimal cost. And one of the things we're doing is raising the cap to $50,000. So it's a small cost considering that these organizations are very effective at helping to make sure that a rate case doesn't disproportionately affect low and moderate income citizens who are customers of those utilities.
And Senator Anderson, what is usually when there is a rate case, does the utility spend on making their case before the
PUC?
That's
usually about $1 million, and that's our very rough estimate. So it's very costly, and this is a very minuscule cost in comparison to that. And the bill, basically, as I said, it really updates the current law by raising the cap and also making some other changes that make it easier to use the law. So there's not so many kind of bureaucratic hurdles that have to be jumped through. But it's also, it takes a lot of the language that's in current rules and puts them in the statute here that you see on page 2 that explain the showing that has to be made by a nonprofit that wishes to try to collect. And it's a pretty strong showing that has to be made. They have to prove that, that their participation made a difference in the outcome of the case and was considered in the outcome of the case, and that it was unique, that this point of view was not presented or represented by anyone else. So duplicate recovery for the same purpose is not permitted. So you can see there's a number of other factors that also must be showings that must be made by an intervener who wishes to receive this limited amount of cost recovery.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Is there any limit on the number of interveners that can present on the rate request? I mean, if we had 10 of them, we'd have $500,000.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, as I said, they can't repeat or be duplicative of the position that was taken by another entity. And where's the language? Let's see. The intervener, if you look at the bottom of page 1, the commissioner has to consider, among other factors, whether the intervener represented an interest that would not otherwise have been adequately represented. And number 4 says the evidence presented, arguments made, issues raised, or positions taken by the intervener would not have been a part of the record without the intervener's participation. So no, you can't have all the multiple interveners coming in for the same purpose. Only one for this particular purpose.
And this is an ongoing practice now.
This has been in law
years. Yeah, there are interveners now.
Yes, this has been going on for many, many years. And and again, I think for our ratepayers that we represent as constituents, they probably don't realize that they pay the utility lawyers when they go in and argue to raise their rates. And they do, and we've determined that that's fair. But I think it's also they would find comfort in knowing that there's a little bit of help there in terms of advocating for their interests and not paying too much of an increase.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Since it has been going on for a while, and how many interveners have been paid at the $20,000 rate there in the past?
Ms. Marshall.
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, I'll just give you, Energy Sense has been in since 1994, probably the 4 major utility rate cases, from 1994 to 2005. But since 2005 and through this coming fall, there will be 4 cases just in that short period of time. So they're coming a lot more rapidly than they have historically. When we participated, we've been compensated once in the early years in a Minnegasco rate case for about $6,000 or so, because that was the extent of our participation in that particular case. We were not compensated, nor did we seek compensation in a Minnesota Power case in the early or mid-90s, because we only acted, Energy Sense only acted as a witness for the senior coalition. They, in turn, sought an award for compensation that was granted. And more recently, in the most recent Xcel Electric rate case, we did submit a claim for $8,300 that was awarded, and yet we have we also have a claim pending now in the most recent CenterPoint case for over $27,000, because that was the extent of our participation there. And I think the original point of this law was to encourage public participation. Just to give you just the slightest idea of these, no one really wants to go in a rate case. They last 10 to 12 months. As this bill, it retains current law, you do have to be granted formal party status, which means then in order to be a part of this, you need to submit direct testimony, surrebuttal, rebuttal testimony, participate in evidentiary hearings, file briefs, submit and answer discovery questions. And it's not just a utility versus the advocate dynamic. Often, given the fact that we're in the room, we come up with negotiated agreements with utilities that end up being a win-win, particularly in our, from our perspective, for low and fixed income people. So, and if we weren't in the room, and we're often the only non-governmental residential organization in the room, and if we weren't there, we wouldn't also have the kind of win-wins that we've seen in the last couple of rate cases.
Madam Chair,
Senator Roebling, we do have a number of other bills, and our jurisdiction is on the rules. The policy committee has acted on the bill.
Trying to get the answer. She indicated when they had been involved, but I'm just wondering how many stakeholders might actually come and present information and be seeking compensation in a single rate case.
Okay.
Besides you,
well, Ms. Marshall.
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, in the last, say, seven cases I know of, the compensation of the Senior Coalition, the compensation of ourselves, and a pending compensatory claim from an individual who participated in the Xcel Electric rate case. There were no other parties, so there were no other claims for compensation. We're, like I said, we're usually it.
Okay. Madam Chair, it's hard for me to understand how they can do this for $7,000 or $8,000 or
$20,000. We have, are there any questions, again, on Section 2, the application of the rules? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 1998 as presented in the first engrossment?
Madam Chair, I should point out that we know of no opposition to this bill.
Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 1998, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is passed. Senator Anderson, are you now ready with Senate File 2041?
Yes, that would be good. Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Senate File, 2041, relates to the Rock 10 plant in the city of St. Paul. This is a recycling plant that recycles cardboard and paper in the city of St. Paul and has 500 good-paying union jobs, and it's been a good neighbor and a plant that we want to keep in our community. And what's happened with a really good effort that's been made by Xcel with the help of the legislature is to convert the old Highbridge coal plant along with some other plants from coal to natural gas. And that's been a really wonderful thing that's been very widely supported in our community. But one of the downsides of that decision is that the steam, which Rock 10 has been using for many years at their production facility, will no longer be available. And, you know, they had built a pipeline to use that steam. And so what we're doing is a variety of different pieces of this proposal, but the parts that you see in front of you today relate to the plan that the Rock 10 company has to build a biomass plant at the facility. And they've been committed to building a renewable energy facility to replace the steam energy that they need to continue running the plant. And the city is very strongly supportive of that proposal. And so the Port Authority, which would own and operate the new biomass plant, has asked for authorization to create a not-for-profit corporation for the purposes of owning or operating the plant, and that's the first part of the bill that relates to the jurisdiction of this committee. And
Senator Anderson, and that was the issue that I had raised in the previous committee,
yes.
And we've already dealt with that one time this evening with the Senator Pappas's bill allowing the Metropolitan Council to establish a not-for-profit corporation, making it subject to all of the laws that underlie that in Section 465.719, and that is what we are that's what we need to amend this bill to include as well, so that they're not you know, they have to do open meeting, they have to do all of those things that were part of the agreement when we prohibited any new not-for-profit corporations to be established by public bodies except for those that were created before 1997 they're prohibited unless they have special legislation. So that's why they need this, but then they also need to come under the rules that were established for the corporations that existed prior to 1997. And so we need the A3 mm-hmm. amendment. Senator Pappas moves the A3 amendment.
And
Senator
Chair,
Anderson,
that.
Do you have mm-hmm. the amendment?
I have the amendment, and I think that's
okay.
Agreed.
And it accomplishes what I just described. Is there any discussion of that? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We also have an A4 amendment, which Senator Pappas, if you would offer for discussion. Okay. And it deals with the issue in the last section, lines 12 through 14, which was an issue raised in the previous committee as well, regarding how do you go about measuring, quote, in line 14, support from community organizations. And Senator Anderson, I believe that you're familiar with this language.
Madam Chair, if I may just say that a concern that I have is to be sure that there is broad community support for this project as it moves forward. I strongly support the project. There is some controversy at the community level about the source, the type of fuel that is used. And so I just want to make sure that during the process of developing this plant and moving forward with it, that there is a full and thorough and vigorous community discussion and debate and input. And that was my attempt to try to have that happen. Now, the A4 amendment is a more refined version of that, and I would be happy to have the committee adopt that. Just if I may say briefly, the City of St. Paul has a district council system, which is a community-based organization that's established by the city and is set up to advise the city, and I believe that they need to have a very vigorous process of involvement in this decision and in the environmental impact statement, et cetera. And so this would be something that would accomplish that, and I think that as we go to the conference committee with the House, they don't have this type of language, so this will allow us to have that discussion about making sure that there's local approval and input for the decision.
Thank you, Senator Anderson, and I think this really does spell it out, and there will be no doubt if these things happen mm-hmm. that the community and the elected officials support your project. Are there questions about the A4 amendment? Senator Pappas renews her motion that the A4 amendment be adopted. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. We now have Senate File 2041 as amended before us. Is there further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 2041? Seeing none, Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 2041, the first engrossment as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
Thank
prevails.
You very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you
for your patience with my schedule tonight. I appreciate that.
Sure. Senator Roebling, finally. Senator Roebling brings Senate File 2174.
Madam Chair, it should be a lot quicker now that you've given me some time to work on this.
So, Senator Roebling, do you have
amendment? Yes, I have a delete all amendment, the A2.
Okay. Senator Roebling moves the delete all amendment to 2174, the amendment A2. Senator Roebling, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Roebling, if you'd like to explain your bill then.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think I will turn right to our members from administration.
Sure.
Because this has been in place, then it was out of statute, Now we're trying to get it back in statute. There is currently an advisory council that is put together, but it hasn't been statutorily approved at this point, although it is absolutely required by the federal government in order to get money for the program that they are administrating.
Senator Roebling, I'm advised that we need to have we need to put in an effective date because it can't be August 1st. It needs to be July 1st.
Madam Chair, it is currently existing, not quite with this language permitting it, however.
Mr. Bottom, do we need to add an effective date?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, it just occurred to me, having put this together just recently, that if we're going to try to get this started before August 1st, understanding that it's already in existence, this calls for gubernatorial appointments and a meeting after that July 1st appointment. It would be helpful to have a July 1st effective date. Without one, it would be August 1st. So you could simply add...
We need a section 2.
You can do it these days just with another sentence at the end of that section with a head note that says effective date, and it would say this section is effective July 1st, 2007.
Do all the members understand that? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Mr. Bonner, just one quick question about that. If the terms begin July 1st, in other words, the first term, they will not be appointed until that time, or can the governor appoint them before it takes effect?
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I think the governor could prepare for July 1st and
just
begin the process.
Madam Chair, a number of these members will probably reapply for appointment, and so it probably won't take too long to fill the positions.
Okay, and Senator Senator Roebling, to the extent that this council... the provisions of our guidelines that this council must meet, your A2 amendment, and I'm going to adopt that amendment to it in just a moment, does meet those guidelines. Is that correct? To the extent that it needs to.
Madam Chair, yes. As far as, especially with the reference to Public Law 108-364, which is a federal law,
mm-hmm.
and that federal law designates who has to be members of this advisory council, and so it is fairly specific as to the membership makeup, and it says that they can't be compensated except for direct expenses. Mm-hmm. The practice has been that they get compensated for mileage, and they have a meal if the meeting is over meal time, and so most of that is covered. If you don't see it here in the amendment,
it's
covered
in the
federal
law.
So
at any rate, we have. Who would convene the first meeting, how long people would serve, the compensation as in that public law before, and that they can select a chair at their first meeting, and that the governor is the appointing authority. Senator Marty moves an amendment to the A2 amendment previously adopted by adding effective date July 1st, 2007. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment to the amendment previously adopted is adopted. Is there further discussion on the bill? And there is a repealer of 16B055 that remains in the bill. Are there any questions? There are witnesses from the Department of Administration ready to speak to answer questions. Are there any questions? Seeing none, Senator Marty moves that Senate File 2174 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Roebling, for your work this evening on this bill. Okie dokie. I think we're moving to Senator Larson. We'll I really do appreciate the members' patience for an extremely long agenda, but we are going to get through 21 bills in 3.5 hours. I think that's a pretty good record. And we will not need to meet tomorrow or Saturday. We will be having an additional meeting because we have some special bills that are going to be late bills that we need to take up, and some informational hearings on others, and that's likely to be Wednesday, not Monday. But if you'd look for an agenda, Senator Larson brings us Senate File 1557. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to start with an author's amendment, the A1 amendment.
We have the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. And it references...
Madam Chair, the easiest way, I think, to explain the amendment or to... show the effect of the amendment is on page one.
Yeah, if you just read what the real sentence would be with the
language that on line 17 of page one, starting with if at the end of the sentence there, deleting if and then all delete all the language on line 18. And then the language on 19, delete that leads up to the stricken language. So essentially the language that precedes
that
the
whole
other
sentence
stricken
language is being deleted.
That's correct, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair,
The reason why this bill comes to this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1557 was brought to me by the Department of Administration, Office of Enterprise Technology, and the Minnesota Historical Society, is essentially a cleanup of our statutes as it relates to records and archival and management. I think one of the things that we're faced with our statute books is, especially in the area of technology, is updating our statutes with the correct language so that we, in fact, are operating in the 21st century. In terms of the medium in which it is stored, Madam Chair. This is what this bill accomplishes, both with the language on page one, but then I'd also draw the attention of members to the repealer language that essentially repeals portions of statute that... that deal with an obsolete form of technology that we no longer need to have in law related to developing standards that was enacted in the early 90s in optical image storage, which is essentially obsolete, and the statute shouldn't refer to it. Don't believe that, Madam Chair, that there is any controversy to the bill. There was initially some discussion from some folks in Olmsted County who had used and may still use some of the optical imaging technology. The amendment that we adopted alleviates their concerns.
Okay.
And so, Madam Chair and members, if you do have questions, we do have Mr. Horton from the Historical Society and Mr. Reese from Office of Enterprise Technology.
Are there questions for the witnesses or Senator Larson? Is there anybody who wishes to speak in either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 1557 as amended? Seeing none, Senator Lori moves that Senate File 1557 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Larson. And I think you have another bill here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate
1556.
Senate File 1556. is also brought to me by the Office of Enterprise Technology as an initiative of the agency. In fact, very straightforward changes, again, references from a technological perspective, and also changes from in statute that are currently designated as Department of Administration, changing those to the correct designation of Office of Enterprise Technology. Again, this is an update of the statute. I think if you page quickly through the bill, mm-hmm. you'll see that what we're doing, in fact, if you look on page 2, we're just, again, being more factual in our statutes about how we should refer to the mediums here. As an example, line 21, deleting voice, data, and video, and in fact, referring to that as information technology. Again, this is an update.
Are there any questions for Senator Larson about the content of this bill? Senator Larson, seems to me this is appropriate for the consent calendar. Senator Roebling moves that Senate file. Is there anyone who wishes to speak in opposition or in support of this bill? Seeing none, Senator Roebling moves that Senate file 1556 be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You bet. Senator Lurie, election provisions modifications. As Senator Lurie is coming to the table, we ran into a little bit of glitch with this bill, sending it to the floor without the amendments that we had thought we had adopted. So we took it back from the floor to, rather than putting amendments on the floor, to fix the bill in the committee where it belonged. So we had previously adopted the subcommittee report from the Committee on Elections. Mr. Bodern, do we need to adopt that subcommittee report again?
Madam Chair, no. You have already done that.
Okay, we've done that. So what we have before us is this is a these were the absolutely and totally non-controversial provisions of the election law changes.
I got to perk up.
Senator Gerlach, you better get alert here. We just need to send it back to the floor with the subcommittee report as amended, that amended 1310 on it. So Senator Lurie moves that Senate file 1310, represented by the subcommittee report on elections, as amended, be recommended to pass. What? Okay, apparently, even though we believe that we took the right motion, the record does not show that we made the right motion. So we need to, first of all, Senator Lurie moves to reconsider the motion by which Senate File 1310 was sent to the floor. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Lurie moves that Senate File 1310, as amended by the subcommittee report on elections, be adopted. All those in favor, approved. All those in favor of that motion, that Senate File 1310, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Vickerman. Where's this one going? Senator Vickerman brings Senate File 2226.
Madam Chair, just to put a little fun this late evening, I looked at the list, and I'm carrying a cemetery bill, but I'm dead last.
A cemetery bill, and you are the very end, and after that, we're all going to just collapse.
Madam Chair, members, this is a bill about cemeteries, Indian burial grounds, and authentic burial grounds, and I have an expert here with me, but I think before they do that, I'd like to put the A1 amendment on so the bill's in order that...
Yes, we have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment to Senate File 2226. All in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment A1 is adopted. Senator Vickerman, if you'd like to have your witnesses.
Because it's a late hour, and I'm sure you want to get
Tell us something about the bill. Be happy to have your testimony on it.
And
either one.
Scott Amundson, and I know you know who this gentleman is.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Rhodes, Department of Administration. First of all, we want to thank you for hearing the bill, and we want to thank Senator Vickerman for carrying it. Mr. Anfinson will testify about the bill, but please keep in mind that he's never, ever testified before any Senate committee in this
existence.
Well, there's
not very many people here to scare him either.
So be gentle.
Oh, scary ones.
Mr. Anfinson, if you just explain the bill, we'll act on it quickly.
Sure. My name is Scott Anfinson. I'm the state archaeologist for Minnesota. Madam Chair, members of the committee, basically the purpose of this bill is to clarify key terminology through the additions of a definition section, to clarify what can be done with proper authority within burial grounds, to organize the act in a more logical and consistent manner, and to clarify and establish appropriate management responsibilities of key players, including private landowners. The draft was circulated to the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, the Minnesota Historical Society, the Department of Transportation, DNR, and the Council for Minnesota Archaeology, and there were no major objections. And basically, the amendment reflects some minor wording changes that were suggested by the Minnesota Historical Society and the Indian Affairs Council, and it also suggests one addition of two sentences based on an amendment that was introduced in the House.
Senator Vickerman, Mr. Anfinson, there are references in the bill to Indian burial grounds and to the Indian Affairs Council. Are they in support of this bill?
I have heard no objections from them, Madam Chair.
As far as you know, there's been no opposition to the bill. Is that correct, Mr. Rhodes, Senator Vickerman? You're not aware
of
any objection?
Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Jones, Jim Jones sat at the table in the House hearing as well, so we don't have any problem with it. They don't have any problem with it that we know of.
Senator Vickerman, on lines 114, and Mr. Rhodes, maybe if you'd look at that, Mr. Anfinson, is the penalty that you are proposing there, is that current law that it is a felony, or does this bill need to go to the Judiciary Committee?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's the current law.
It's a current law. It's just rewording it here.
Just putting Nothing's it in a more logical changed. Order.
Okay.
It's very confusing.
No new penalty is being created.
18.
Okay. Senator Marty?
It's crossed out. Two lines later.
Okay.
But I had a question for Mr. Anfinson.
Sure.
When we're talking about remains found outside of recorded cemeteries, I recognize you, from time to time you find tribal cemeteries and so on, but I know, like, in right off the border of Minneapolis, I know one cemetery of 10 graves or so. It was a pauper's field type of thing. How many cemeteries are there, and do you keep finding them every couple years? Or,
Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I get a call probably every day about some cemetery. Half of those are Indian burial mounds, which there's 12,500 recorded in the state, and the other half are little private cemeteries on people's land or abandoned cemeteries.
Okay. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Roebling.
Can I just ask a quick question about it says that posting is not required for, like, if somebody shoots a gun over a cemetery. And I'm thinking of all these little tiny cemeteries that are being discovered, that it's somebody walking through a field may not be aware of, but they could be guilty of a gross misdemeanor for firing a gun over them. And I'm just wondering, if it's a practical thing.
Madam Chair, Senator, that's in the existing law, and I'm one of the people that can give people permission to fire a gun over in the existing law, and we're getting rid of that. It came up because people were shooting up Indian spirit houses up north. Duck hunters would see one of these bark lodges that's an Indian, and they were shooting them up. So that's why that's in the law. But I think it only refers to authenticated cemeteries. That if you weren't aware, you have to intentionally and willfully do it. And if you're not aware there's a cemetery there, there's no willful intent.
Okay, Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 2226, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Vickerman. Again, we may be meeting at least one more time, probably next Wednesday, not Monday. Look for a notice for a couple of late bills that we need to deal with, and or we have a, oh, and we have a few confirmations that we have not yet dealt with that we will deal with then. Otherwise, there being no further business before this committee, we are adjourned.